Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the EIM Governance Review Committee General Session Meeting. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. If you require assistance during the call, please press star, then zero. And as a reminder, this conference is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to our host, Roger Collington. Please go ahead, sir.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome. I will start out with a roll call, and then I'll turn it over to Therese to manage the agenda. So let's start with the roll call. Tony Braun?
Here.
Andrew Campbell?
Here.
Dan Cooper?
Here.
Eric Eisenman?
Here.
Valerie Fong?
Here.
Angelina Golitova? Angelina? Okay. Jennifer Gardner?
Here.
Therese Hampton?
Here.
Doug Howe? Doug? Okay. Christine Raper?
Present.
Rob Taylor?
Here.
Rebecca Wagner?
Here.
Mary Winky?
Here.
Cameron Yurkowski?
I'm here.
Okay. We don't have Angelina and Doug, but we do have a quorum, and we can continue. So let me turn that over to you, Therese.
Terrific. I think our first order of business is a decision on the general session minutes from December 4th.
Actually, we have a...
From January 21st.
Right, right. Yeah, from December 4th. We do have public comment on the agenda, so that's the... And I'll just state that. That's the item that we have standing on the agenda. If there's any public comment that is not about a particular agenda item. So if there's any public comment... then this would be the opportunity for people to speak. Operator, is there any public comment?
If there's a comment, please press zero, then, or please press one, then zero. I have nobody in queue.
Excellent. Thank you.
You're welcome.
General session minutes. We need a motion to approve the January 21st, 2020 general session minutes for the Governance Review Committee. Wait.
This is Rebecca. So moved.
Oh. Wait a second. We're getting some confusion here. I'm advised that that was actually a December 4th, 2019. The January 21 was not a general session. Sorry for the confusion. So let me start again. We need a motion to approve the December 4th, 2019 general session minutes for the Governance Review Committee.
This is Rebecca. So moved.
Rebecca. And second?
This is Jennifer. I second that.
Okay. And given that we're on the phone, this is a little clunky, but I need to go through and get your votes for each of you. Tony?
Aye.
Andrew?
Aye.
Suzanne?
Aye.
Eric?
Aye.
Sorry, Valerie, you're non-voting. Jennifer?
Aye.
Therese?
Aye.
Christine?
Aye.
Rob?
Aye.
Rebecca?
Aye.
Mary?
Aye.
Cameron?
Aye.
And I'm assuming Doug Howe has not joined us. If and when, Doug, speak up. And we can move on to hand it back over to you, Therese. Thank you.
Thank you, Roger. Doug is not going to be with us today. He had notified us that he is unavailable, so we will good morning to everyone. Thank you for joining us. We're really glad you could be here. We appreciate everybody joining by webinar. I know that all of us were really looking forward to being in Phoenix and being in person and hoping to see a lot of you there, but we really understand the circumstances and appreciate the circumstances, and so we trust and hope that you and your colleagues stay healthy through all of this, and we're really looking forward to a robust conversation today. And we're going to encourage you to kind of engage differently than maybe you do on normal webinars and call-ins. We want you to use the chat feature, and we want you to really kind of take the opportunity to ask questions and to offer comments through this. What I'm going to do this morning, I'm going to give you just a brief update about where we're at in the process, and then an overview of the agenda that we have for this morning. So if we go to the next slide, this is just a bit of an orientation for everybody about who the Governance Review Committee members are. You heard kind of the names referenced in the roll call. The next slide, these slides take a little bit of a delay. there's just going to be a list of who we all are. I think we want to go to the next slide. There we go. Just a list of who the Governance Review Committee members are, and you heard our names, but you can kind of see our affiliations here. This is really just for reference for you. If we go to the next slide, we'll talk a little bit about kind of the focus of the Governance Review Committee and where we're at in the process. The Governance Review Committee will focus exclusively on governance issues. That's the purpose for the Governance Review Committee's kind of main charge. And we will look at proposed governance changes for two scenarios, the current energy imbalance market, looking at that if a day-ahead market expansion does not go forward, what kind of changes might be recommended to the energy imbalance market governance, and if there is approval to go forward with the extension of the day-ahead market. That's really the primary focus of this committee. We'll do that really through a couple of ways. First, one of our primary goals is to develop a process to solicit and get feedback from all of you stakeholders and take that input to form proposals that we'll share with all of you for public comment, and ultimately then put together a proposal that we would submit to the governing body and the Board of Governors for their approval. So that's really the process that we're going through. And if we go to the next slide, we're really kind of early in the process. We started this process by developing a scoping document that was released on January 29th, and we held a webinar to kind of go through the scoping document on February 5th to kind of share the six major issue areas that we had identified in the scoping document and just kind of outline the process for you from there. We've received 16 sets of comments from stakeholders. Those are all posted online, so you can read those comments. And then part of what our goal is here today is to just learn a little bit more about those comments, hear directly from stakeholders that submitted comments, and then also have the opportunity to ask questions, clarifying questions, other questions, and that's part of what we're going to invite you to do today as well. If we go to the next slide, the next slide is a version of the schedule that was shared during the February 5th webinar when we went over the scoping document. And what was kind of laid out here was a schedule that the Governance Review Committee put together about what it would take to get from here to a draft final proposal by the end of the year. I'm going to note that we had identified a straw proposal being posted on April 28th. We've put that as tentative on this schedule because we've received a lot of really good information through the stakeholder comment process, and there's a lot for us to digest. Also, the fact that we are not in person today and haven't had that opportunity, this might suggest that the schedule that you see here could change, and that's one of the things that we're going to do after our conversation today is meet as a committee and really talk about where we think we're at and and where we think our next step might be. So one of the next communications you might see from us is an updated schedule, really kind of to put some realism into what we can do here. So with that, let me tell you a little bit about the agenda. We're going to transition to the agenda that we have today. And like I said, we had planned to be in person, so we kind of planned a dynamic approach to the conversation today that we're going to try to implement via webinar, and we're hopeful that it will work well, but it will kind of require your involvement and engagement in this. Shortly after the February 5th webinar, we sent out a market notice and asked for stakeholders that might be interested in providing comment to indicate their interest. And we had five different participants say that they were willing to share their thoughts and comments here at this meeting. So we will hear from them first. We will hear from the EIM entities, from PG&E, from the body of state regulators, from Northwest Public Power, and from the public interest organizations. And we've asked them to give about 5 minutes or so of an overview of some of the main points from their comments. We'll ask the Governance Review Committee. We won't take comments through those presentations. We'll ask the Governance Review Committee at the end of that for any clarifying questions that they might have. And then we're going to transition into a moderated discussion of the major issue areas that have been in the scoping paper. And so we'll have a Governance Review Committee member ask the panelists some questions. We'll let you ask the panelists some questions. The Governance Review Committee can ask questions, and that's really where we want to open dialogue, but we'll put it into specific topic areas so that we stay focused on, for instance, delegation of authority, selection of the EIM governing body. So that's the plan for the morning. Depending on how the timelines go, we will plan to take a break, so everybody will have a chance to take a break. And so we're going to transition now into the panelist presentations. And we just encourage you, if you have a question while they're going through the presentation, whether it's a clarifying question or otherwise, go ahead, jot it down for yourself so that when we open up for questions, you can do that. Or if you want to just put it in the chat box, we'll have CAISO staff be willing to read those questions when it comes time for question and answer. So with that, we're going to transition, and we're going to start with Josh Walter and David Rubin representing the EIM entities, and they will give the first overview of their interests relative to governance.
Thanks, Therese. So the EIM entities and I thank you for the opportunity to present and discuss the governance structure of both the Western Energy Imbalance Market and the governance structure for a potential future extension of CAISO's day-ahead market. As you know, the EIM entities are a geographically and resource-diverse set of utilities who are currently participating or have formal plans to participate in the Western EIM. We're eager and excited to be participating in this governance review process and believe governance of both the EIM and EDAM are as important as the market design elements of both markets. The EIM entities have spent a significant amount of time evaluating both the potential market design and governance structure of for a future EDAM. As we have mentioned in our comments, governance is a gating issue for many of us, and the decisions that are made in this forum have the potential to determine whether or not certain EIM entities will participate in EDAM. Through our cooperation and coordination, the EIM entities created a well-documented straw proposal illustrating a high level of cooperation and thought put into EIM and EDAM governance. The items and elements outlined in the straw proposal are the EIM entities' high-level preferred outcomes. However, we do acknowledge that we're at the beginning stage of the governance review process and fully understand that there will be deliberation and multiple views on any number of topics and subtopics under consideration. In developing the straw proposal, the EIM entities considered how different governance elements would work together, such that it's important not to change particular elements in isolation without consideration of a comprehensive solution. We're open to dialogue on various options as the GRC process evolves, with the understanding that changes in one area might necessitate further consideration in other areas. Today, I don't intend to walk through our comments in their entirety, but would like to reiterate some of the more salient points in both our comments and the straw proposal to highlight what we believe are the most important elements for future governance of both the EIM and EDIM. First, the EIM entities have outlined a set of overarching principles to help guide the decision-making process of the GRC. These principles are: state regulatory and local authorities must retain authority over issues such as resource adequacy and environmental policies. The opportunity for inconsistencies in policies over these critical areas would result in limited participation to full removal of participation for some EIM entities. An EDAM governance structure must be consistent with CAISO's inherent corporate structure, and with that, the CAISO's Board of Governors must ensure that the EIM and EDAM governing body does not undermine the Board of Governors' legal and business affairs under California corporate law. Finally, for balancing authority areas, stakeholders and regulators external to California to have the confidence in the successful operation of the market, the design of the market's governance structure must achieve the maximum level of independence possible under current laws and policies. Additionally, beyond these overreaching principles, there are a number of governance design elements that the EIM entity strongly encouraged the Governance Review Committee to consider. These issues relate to the models for decisional classification, including delegation of authority, which would include rules subject to the governing body's primary authority and the use of the consent agenda, rules subject to approval by the Board of Governors alone, and the potential for hybrid or joint authority where both bodies vote on their respective agendas and or in combined sessions. The selection of governing body members, which has largely been a success in identifying and attracting knowledgeable and dedicated members with both diverse experience and diverse geographical representation, but it could be expanded to help meet the growing needs of the market and with the end goal of meeting the maximum level of independence with respect to oversight of the EIM and EDIM. The deliberative process, including meetings and engagement with stakeholders, could be expanded to incorporate a member advisory committee that would be a formal advisory channel in providing opinion and counsel directly to the governing body. Additionally, as a growing number of customer-owned utilities or COUs and PMAs like BCA and WAPA become market participants, more formal representation for these bodies that oversee the COAs and PMAs is warranted either through representation on the BOSTER, a BOSTER-like body, or alternatively through an independent body. The policy initiative catalog and the policy initiative roadmap are important tools in planning the development of the market and ongoing policy and market improvements. A more formal role for the governing body is warranted to provide not only input, but also make decisions on what initiatives move forward and the direction these initiatives take in improving market performance. The governing body should have the support of an independent market expert to provide the governing body with additional perspectives on complex and highly technical issues the governing body will need to review and make decisions upon. In cases where there may be disagreements among market participants, DMM, MSC, and CAISO staff, this independent market expert would provide the governing body a direct and unbiased level of analysis to help guide their decision-making and help guide and build a well-functioning market. There are various other important issues, such as dispute resolution processes, budget, durability, or permanence to the governing body, to name a few, that are described in more detail in our straw proposal that we encourage the GRC and others to review and act upon. But for the sake of time, I will simply encourage the committee to read and review independently. In closing, this statement was constructed to highlight some of the more important elements outlined in the EIM entity's comments and straw proposal. They're by no means an exhaustive description of our position on every governance element being delivered upon through this process, but I do thank you for your time in consideration of the EIM's comments and straw proposal. Thank you.
Thank you, Josh. Appreciate that. I want to just make a note before we transition to the next presenter. I really encourage you to use the chat box, but it looks like it's not working right now. So as I noted, just keep your questions on a notepad to yourself. When we get to question and answer, we'll be looking forward to you asking those questions. If we get the chat box back, we'll let you know. And so thank you, Josh, again for that presentation. Now we'll transition to Matt LaCar from PG&E. And if we go to the next slide, I think we have a slide for Matt and his material.
Okay, can everybody hear me okay?
Yes, we hear you.
Great. So I'm going to be presenting PG&E's company view. So just to separate for complete transparency, Eric Eisenman, my colleague, sits on the Governance Review Committee. So as a member of the GRC, he's chartered to express his best objective opinion. So this is the PG&E position and summary of comments that we submitted. So PG&E certainly supports the activity of the GRC. We think that EIM governance today in the current real-time-only market is working well, and we would advocate for a continued strong function for the EIM governing body. We think the current selection process and nominating process work well, and if there's minor adjustments that is required, we're certainly willing to help with that. But in general, the transition to EDAM, we think, should be the primary concern of this GRC. We think that really with EDAM, should it come about, the shared governance model will go from being the exception to being the rule, and the majority of stakeholder activity under the ISO will transition really from a balancing area matter to a shared governance model. And so that's the spirit in which we've developed these comments. So our vision is, I'll say, a three-point plan that we think would work together as elements of a future EDAM shared governance model. Those 3 points are a bright line test to replace the current but-for test. And I'll explain that on the next slide in a second. A joint approval model for issues that affect either the day-ahead market, the real-time market in combination with the day-ahead market, or span across markets. There really is no simple way to create a but-for when you're talking about the entire day-ahead market. It's really, at this point, a question of what, it's easier to determine what isn't in EDAM than to determine what is. And I think part of the discussion will be, you know, where during the governance review process will we know enough about the shape of EDAM and about what portions of the ISO's tariff and activity it implicates to be able to specify those rules. So all we're proposing today is the bright line test be some sort of mapping between the sections of the ISO tariff that describe market features and the governance path that each initiative would follow based on what section of the tariff it seeks to change. The second element is a joint approval model. So for those initiatives that are, you know, under the shared governance, we would view the two bodies, the CAISO Board of Governors and the EIM governing body, future EDAM governing body, meeting in joint session multiple times a year and acting as a single body. We think that's the fairest and likely best way to get surface all issues, have all parties share an equal stake in outcomes, and engender the kind of trust that will make EDAM successful. And then the third element, which I think we would entertain in current EIM if there is interest, but certainly becomes more critical as we move into EDAM is an expansion of the number of members on the governing body itself. So we can move to my second slide. Just to drill down for a second on the specifics of those three proposals, again, the bright line test as the first element. We had some ideas about sections of the ISO tariff and how you would divide those up. I won't get into the specifics here, but essentially matters that pertain to the ISO as a balancing authority, such as transmission planning and interconnection rules, and potentially other sections of the tariff that are germane to California resource adequacy, for example, would remain under the exclusive authority of the California, the CAISO Board of Governors. I always caveat the California piece because we do have one Nevada entity that's part of the CAISO balancing area. The joint approval model, so that there would be essentially a two- or three-way split, and we're at this point, I don't think we know enough about EDAM versus EIM and whether there will be a significant continued role for EIM exclusive or primary authority governance over the real-time only market. But to date, there have been a couple of initiatives focused on the EIM section of the tariff, and we would see those, you know, continuing to be primarily under the jurisdiction of the EIM governing body. As I mentioned, there are issues that remain with the CAISO Board of Governors as the exclusive authority for the balancing area. And then the bulk of everything else, which is, you know, the majority of stakeholder activity within the CAISO, would be decided, or initiatives would be brought to a joint approval session for vote of the combined forces of both governing bodies. And then the final element is an expansion. We think five members on the governing body, first of all, has worked well to date. You know, we've recruited excellent governors or governing body members with a wide range of experience. We think that, you know, as the footprint is growing, as the diversity of viewpoints within the stakeholder community grows, it's appropriate to think about expanding the membership. And that has the added benefit of changing the vote-weighted structure of the joint approval body. That's not an essential requirement that we've heard from anybody. We're just kind of taking a stab in the direction of what used to be called the House and Senate model when folks were debating full regionalization, meaning that to some extent, you know, there's still a understandable question within the EIM community about the gubernatorial appointment process and the statutory California-specific nature of the CAISO Board of Governors. What we wanted to say is that's not in this joint approval model. You know, those folks are independent of any financial interest, but they certainly, you know, are to some extent selected based on California criteria. We wanted to make sure that the weighting given to that voice on the joint approval shared jurisdiction, you know, accurately reflected California's kind of role within the broader EDAM. So I'll stop there. Happy to take any questions.
Great. Thanks, Matt. We'll save the clarifying questions till we've heard from all the presenters, but thank you so much for that presentation. We'll hear now from Oregon PUC Commissioner Lisa Tani giving comments for the body of state regulators. If we can go to her presentation, that would be great. Commissioner Tani.
Thank you so much. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you.
Wonderful. So thank you very much. I'm Lisa Tani, excuse me, the chair of the EIM Body of State Regulators and the a commissioner at the OPUC. And the BOSR really appreciates this opportunity to participate in the GRC dialogue. We believe developing a robust governance approach for this regional market is really crucial to ensuring customers across the West can access the cost savings and efficiency benefits of sharing resources. My comments today represent the consensus BOSTR members have found on these issues to date, but just a reminder, they don't bind any state commission or BOSTR member on future decisions that may come before them. So the BOSTR is the Regional States Committee engaged in the Western EIM, and our tasks and roles are really scoped to the current structure of the regional market. And to that end, we're much smaller than our peer Regional States Committees, OPSI and OMS and RSC, though we are growing rapidly as utilities in different states decide to join. So we have one regulator from each commission in the market footprint, and that's 8 today, including California. I find sometimes folks forget that we have California participation in the BOSTR, and we will have 3 additional states by 2022 because the EIM has been very successful. So the BOSTR plays a unique role in the governance of the Western EIM, and so the perspectives that we share in this process are unique. But just to articulate for folks who may not be as familiar, that role doesn't include at the moment any formal decision or regulatory authority over decisions made by the market operator. We're not a layer of regulation in this process. We primarily make engagement with and by state commissions and by extension state governments more efficient and effective for the market operator, CAISO, market participants, and stakeholders broadly. Our first objective is education. We operate as a resource and focal point for the 11 state commissions to learn about the market, both to come up to speed as turnover happens on commissions and to stay up to date on the multiple complex proceedings that impact states. This task we find is really a crucial complement to the investments our commissions are making across the West in our own staff so that they can ensure public benefits of market participation at the local level. It doesn't replace that in-state investment, but it helps make those in-state investments we're each making more efficient. So each state doesn't reinvent the wheel, ask for their own training, spend market participant, market operator time on immaterial issues that are rooted in our own misunderstanding. As we add states through 2022, that learning objective is taxing. Even when all the states have participated for some time, though, the sort of turnover that is the nature of state commissions and the continued evolution of the market will both make education a long-term need and objective for the BOSTR. Our second objective, as we engage in these processes broadly and in the GRC specifically, is reflecting consensus positions. So we reflect consensus positions to the governing body, and those positions really provide those decision makers important information on where state interests are aligned and where there are questions before them that are raising concerns in states. And that's crucial to knowing where there are potholes, misunderstandings, or opposition to actions that need to be addressed in order to move smoothly forward. What a consensus position also means in practice, as we've observed, as we've engaged together as the BOSTR, but also as we hear our peers in OMS and other state committees talking, it means in practice the BOSTR can't advocate for an individual state generating resources or position in the market. As regulators, we, of course, are not advocating for an individual market participant regardless. But we cannot find consensus on positions that benefit one resource or market participant over others. The nature of finding a consensus position means that we have to really listen to each other and bring forward common views that balance across the diverse interests of the West. We get to that consensus by seeing an issue emerging and asking BOSTR staff to arrange a training or a short briefing on the issue. Then that training, we really require that to be neutral because the BOSTR incorporates so many state interests across the diverse West. If one of our commissions took the lead on a contentious issue, it would be difficult to build from that to consensus potentially, given the complexity of views across WEC. We discuss if we want to comment, and if we were to comment, what the shape of those comments, what consensus we can find. And if we decide we want to weigh in, staff reflects those emerging positions in written comments, which then we work together on to hone and ensure everyone, it really reflects the consensus view everyone can find. I think there's often I run into a point of confusion for some stakeholders, so I'll just take this moment in this forum to clarify. The Western Energy Interstate Board is not the BOSSER, and you'll see here that WE does not direct our comments, does not review our comments, does not approve our comments. Our comments really emerge from the BOSSER members. There is independent staff housed at WE, and that's because WE is trusted by the state governors and policymakers as a neutral convener for us under its interstate compact. Those staff provide some facilitation and scribe roles for us. The BOSSER is independent of the WE board. So to suggest otherwise, I think really discounts the important information that the BOSSER consensus comments provide to stakeholders on where the states are seeing alignment and where market actions are making state regulators uncomfortable about the impacts locally. And finally, we engage in the nomination as the governing body members, and we take that role very seriously and think very hard in our conversations about regional diversity and expertise and diversity of experience. Next slide, please. So as the BOSSER engages together on a regional market, we have strong and diverse but deeply informed views on accountability and good governance. And in that process, we found consensus on these points. So the governing body should be empowered with a clear scope of decisions that reflect the impact those decisions have on other participating balancing areas, on those outside the California balancing area. That body should be staffed and have sufficient access to analysis and resources so that they can make informed and independent decisions. Though any analysis or advice they draw from should be available to stakeholders for reaction and response, with executive sessions used only in a limited fashion. This transparency and independence together really support regional trust in the decisions they're empowered to make. Similarly, building trust regionally and recognizing, as the prior presenter discussed, the overarching board will continue for the foreseeable future to be appointed exclusively by California interests. Building that trust will really require public interest stakeholders from around the West are able to weigh in before decision makers in reasonable proportion to the market participants. Market participants are very reasonably motivated on behalf of those who profit from their engagement to allocate resources to the process. It's a part of their cost of doing business or accessing the economic opportunities in the market. Public interest stakeholders from across the West who do not represent groups of market participants or market participants specifically, but are impacted by those choices, must be able to effectively engage in order to build trust with constituencies that may be uncomfortable with the formal governance remaining rooted exclusively in California. That is both time and processes to wrestle complicated material to the ground and arrive at well-reasoned positions and the resources to do so. And, you know, just to be very clear, given that the California-centric approach will continue for the leading board, there is a need for the remaining governance infrastructure, both the formal and the somewhat informal, to close that trust deficit and create a transparent governance approach that builds trust so states outside California can increment their level of engagement forward. Finally, decision-making processes must be transparent. In our own commissions, we operate from records where stakeholders broadly can respond to each other to paint a full picture for us as decision makers. We strive to make those processes transparent so there's confidence in the decisions we make as regulators. That same transparency needs to be present throughout the Western market decision process. State regulators need to feel confident the governing body's decisions are fair or broadly and effectively informed by more than the market participants of who benefit from a specific resource and will be respected by the board. I really look forward to the continued dialogue and the panel today. I appreciate everyone flexing with the webinar approach and look forward to a good engagement and questions. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Commissioner Otani. And now we'll transition to a presentation by Leah Fisher on behalf of Northwest Public Power.
Hi, my name is Leah Fisher, and I'm representing Public Generating Pool and Northwest Public Power, and I appreciate the opportunity to present today. The perspectives I will be sharing are based on a set of governance interests for EDAM that were developed with a broader Northwest Public Power group, and this includes, in addition to Public Generating Pool, the Public Power Council, PNGC Power, and Northwest Requirements Utility. And the intent of developing these EDAM interests was to explore whether a delegated approach to governance can achieve sufficient independence so that the decision-making represents and balances the interests of all stakeholders across the market footprint. Next slide, please. Oh, okay, we're there. Never mind, we're good. Collectively, the Northwest Public Power Group serves over 8,400 average megawatts of load, and our members own hydroelectric facilities with a total nameplate capacity over 7,400 megawatts. In addition, our members comprise the majority of BPA's preference load and fund the majority of BPA's power operation and overall costs. Our members serve load in 8 states, including Oregon, Washington, Montana, Idaho, Nevada, Utah, Wyoming, and California. Today, I'd like to review 3 primary important areas that we believe should be a focus for change in the current governance structure if EDAM were to be implemented. But before I start, I want to note that governance is a vital interest to Northwest Public Power. But in addition, we believe that governance is just one of the foundational aspects of market expansion and that it must also be considered alongside fair and robust market design and oversight. Next slide, please. The first primary area we recommend for governance change is to provide for durable decision-making that reflects the interests of the entire footprint, which on this slide is highlighted in the green box. The remainder of the slide captures the 6 primary elements that we believe are needed to achieve that goal. The dark blue box indicates and reflects our recommendation that the independent governing body should have primary authority over real-time and day-ahead market rules, with the exception of those market rules that solely apply to the CAISO BAA. We believe that this ensures decision-making that is representative of all market participants and stakeholder interests. However, we also believe that delegation of decision-making alone does not ensure that that delegation is durable, and so the gray boxes in this picture highlight issues that we believe are necessary to ensure that durable delegation. On the left-hand side in the gray boxes, we recommend that the majority of the ISO board as well as the independent governing body be required to change the scope of delegated authority or to defund or dissolve the governing body itself. We believe that this ensures the existence of the independent governing body and its delegation of authority is durable through potential challenges and differences that may arise. The gray boxes on the right hand reflect our recommendation for third-party dispute resolution. We believe a dispute resolution process is really important for times when the ISO board and independent governing body may not be aligned and ensures that the durability of delegated authority remains. And finally, the orange box on the bottom captures an essential feature under a delegated decision-making model, and that is that entities participating in EDAM must be able to withdraw within 180 days for any reason and with no exit fees, similar to the approach that's currently in place for EIM participants. We believe this provides protections for market participants in the event of future changes to the function of the delegated authority model that may not be acceptable to participants. PGP believes that these changes all work together as a package to ensure the delegated authority of the independent governing body is durable and reflects the interests of the entire market footprint. Next slide, please. The second area for primary governance change we recommend is the addition of an independent market expert that reports directly to the independent governing body. As market design issues become more complex and they impact a broader regional area, we believe an independent market expert is really warranted, and they will act as an expert resource on market design and to regularly assess market function. Under our proposal, the independent market expert would provide direct analysis and input to the independent governing body on market design issues. And further, they would have access to market data to conduct routine reviews to assess the function of the market and effectiveness in particular of issues related to resource efficiency and GHG accounting. The independent market expert will complement but not replace the role of the Department of Market Monitoring and the Market Surveillance Committee. In our perspective, these entities have a very different role than the independent market expert. Notably, DMM must meet FERC requirements of market monitoring and regular reporting, and under our proposal, this would remain the sole function of DMM. We do not believe that DMM and the Market Surveillance Committee can serve in the role of the independent market expert, and that's because they're created by and report directly to the ISO Board of Governors. And while they do provide reports and input to the EIM governing body, their origination and their purpose is through and developed by the ISO Board of Governors. Next slide, please. So the third area we're proposing for governance change is the creation of advisory committees to the independent governing body. We recommend the development of a stakeholder advisory committee that is modeled off the Regional Issues Forum, but would be able to offer advisory opinions and make recommendations on active issues and CAISO stakeholder processes. We believe the stakeholder-driven discussions at the Regional Issues Forum have been really useful and have provided more understanding and alignment among market participants and stakeholders. And we believe this can only be enhanced if the issues within the committee's purview are expanded. We do not believe it is necessary for the advisory committees to have voting requirements or for the independent governing body to be required to receive an advisory opinion prior to deciding an issue. In addition, PVP believes it is essential for the regulatory and consumer interests of public power to be represented, the same way that the IOU regulatory and consumer interests are currently represented through the body of state regulators. Public power sales represent more than 30% of the sales in the Western Interconnection, and while IOU regulatory and consumer interests are currently represented through the BOSR, there's no comparable representation for public power. So PGP believes this could be addressed by adding public power representation either to the BOSR or creating a new public power body. Next slide, please. In summary, this slide provides a comprehensive overview of PGP's EDAM governance proposal. It attempts to capture our three primary areas of change that we recommend. So just to cover those one more time, the first one is the delegation of primary authority to the independent governing body for the real-time and day-ahead market design issues, while still maintaining the ISO Board of Governors' ability to reject any proposals. The second is the creation of an independent market expert that reviews market design proposals and routine market function. And the third is the creation of advisory committees that have the opportunity to give input to the independent governing body. And that concludes my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Leah. And now we'll transition to our last presentation. Jennifer Gardner will share a presentation representing the public interest organizations. Comments and perspective.
Wonderful. Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Let's go ahead and transition to the next slide, please. While that is coming up, this should be, yep, there we go. Slide number two is my disclaimer slide. I just wanted to make sure that folks understand that when I am presenting today, I'm presenting on behalf of the following public interest organizations. So as you can see from this list, this is by no means an exhaustive list of public interest groups from across the West, but it is a solid group of organizations that have been routinely engaged in regional market issues over the past 5 or 6 years. So these comments represent NRDC, Northwest Energy Coalition, Western Grid Group, and Western Resource Advocates. Also, I am technically an appointed member of the Governance Review Committee, but for purposes of today's presentation, I am here in a very different capacity. I am simply here to present the governance-related views of this coalition of public interest organizations, so nothing that I say today should be construed to represent the views of the Governance Review Committee or any individual member or groups of members of that committee. Next slide, please. So what I'd like to do as that slide is coming up is just provide an overview of our comments. And given that we only have 5 minutes to provide an overview, I'll try to keep this pretty high level and focus on the issues that are of greatest importance to these public interest organizations. So I think the first issue, and probably one of the most important issues to us, is the delegation authority, the delegation of authority for market rules to the governing body. I think at a high level, public interest organizations believe that the Governance Review Committee, as it's working through this process, should strive to put both boards, the governing body and the CAISO Board of Governors, on equal footing. So we've heard a lot from the prior presentations that there must be a way to simplify this process, whether you're hearing about a bright line distinction between authority or something else. The idea is that we should be giving more independence, more power to the governing body, but we should also make this process much more simple. So the public interest organizations have laid out two options for potentially accomplishing this. The first option is to delineate governance between interstate markets and services versus California-only markets and services. So you could also view this as regional markets and services versus California-specific. An example of this model would be where the EIM and EDM were in place, both of those markets would be under the authority of the governing body, whereas anything that was unique to California, so a great example would be the transmission planning process, would fall within the exclusive authority of the CAISO Board of Governors. So that is one way for creating sort of this bright line distinction between the authority of the governing body versus the authority of the CAISO Board of Governors. The second option is to create a dual board governance model where the CAISO Board of Governors and the governing body have shared roles in governing the various markets. So I think we've heard from a number of the presenters different ways that this could be accomplished. In the option two that we're proposing, we are essentially assuming that most market-based decisions going forward will naturally overlap between the CAISO Board of Governors' authority and the governing body's authority. In other words, it's very hard to parcel out differences between tariff changes that only affect California versus tariff changes that will affect the region at large as we add more market services. So affirmative approval would require a majority vote by both boards, and where approval cannot be obtained would require CAISO management to develop a revised proposal for both boards' reconsideration. This dual board construct is actually already being used today within the EIM governance framework, including with regard to the EDAM and GRC stakeholder initiatives. So this would simply be expanding that model and having it include more decision-making going forward. Now, there would be situations where a decision would be unique to the CAISO Board of Governors, similar to option one. A great example of that, again, is the transmission planning process, because EDAM will not involve coordinated transmission planning. Those types of decisions could be left exclusively to the CAISO Board of Governors. Additionally, the public interest organizations want to offer this overarching consideration for the Governance Review Committee. We believe it's important to consider eliminating the requirement that the CAISO Board of Governors provide final approval of decisions that fall squarely within the authority of the governing body. So, you know, the way that this is represented today is even where a decision is within the primary authority of the governing body, the CAISO Board of Governors ultimately has the ability to remove that approval from its consent agenda with a majority vote and to essentially reject that proposal. Now, we haven't really seen examples of that, and that's probably speaking to the governance model working very well today. But as we add market services, as we create complexity in the market, it's not certain that that existing model will continue to work so effectively. So we want to, again, emphasize that the goal should be to put both boards on equal footing wherever possible, and that where a decision is final by the governing body, it should be considered final. Where that decision is final under the dual board model, where both boards have approved it, it should be considered final, and we shouldn't require an additional level of approval before a CARA filing is eventually made at FERC. So let's go to the next slide, please. The second issue, and this is on slide 4, the process for selecting EIM governing body members. The second issue of greatest importance to the public interest organizations, perhaps not surprisingly, is that the public interest and consumer advocate group sector of the EIM nominating committee should be given a voting role on that committee. So today we have a number of stakeholder sectors that are represented on the nominating committee. Of those sectors, only 3 sectors are not given a voting role. That's the CAISO Board of Governors, the EIM governing body, and the public interest and consumer advocate group sector. Now in practice, the nominating committee has actually operated on a consensus basis of all of its members. Now technically in the charter, the nominating committee should be operating on a consensus of its voting members. But I will say that in practice, that has not been the case. Pretty much every sector weighs in, provides some type of decision-making role in the process, and that has worked quite well. There are only 2 sectors who have abstained from voting or otherwise formally weighing in on this process in the past, and that would be the CAISO Board of Governors and EIM governing body sectors. The reasons for this are probably obvious. The EIM governing body has a role in approving candidates to the governing body, so they are understandably conflicted. When we seated the first nominating committee, when we seated the first governing body, the CAISO Board of Governors was actually the responsible entity for approving the members to the governing body. Again, they were conflicted. Going forward, now that that role is being left to the EIM governing body to approve candidates, additional concerns may sometimes arise, which may create the need for the CAISO Board of Governors sector to not formally weigh in on candidates. And this could be best described as undue influence concerns, given the ultimate authority that the CAISO Board of Governors has in this current governance model. Sometimes there have been concerns that they should take a step back, provide less formal input in the process, but certainly not vote. So none of these concerns apply equally to the public interest and consumer advocate group sector. In fact, we are more comparable to the other stakeholder sectors. And so the thinking here is that there is a process in place today where the public interest and consumer advocate group sector already weighs in on this process, already provides formal decision-making in the process. Let's just make sure that we clarify that in the governance documents. And in addition, there really aren't conflict of interest concerns or certainly undue influence concerns with providing the stakeholder sector with a vote. Let's go to the next slide, please. I'm going to quickly cover this slide. This is the governing body meetings and engagement with stakeholders. And I think that most of our recommendations are focused on, we like the way that the EIM governing body meetings are working today across the region. We think this symbolizes the regional nature of the market, provides additional opportunities for engagement with regional stakeholders that might not otherwise exist if those meetings took place in Folsom exclusively. We also have slightly changed our position regarding the formation of a stakeholder advisory committee or members advisory committee. We don't believe that such a formal committee is needed, at least not yet. And I do want to note that there is a lot of interest in formalizing a role for stakeholders or market participants. You've heard that today already. But I do want to say that from the public interest sector, any future stakeholder advisory committee or member advisory committee must be able to adequately represent all stakeholder interests and not just the interests of market participants. Additionally, within this section, the public interest organizations believe that the governance review committee should consider the issue of funding for the body of state regulators. And we also emphasize that precedent exists to provide this type of funding. Currently, there are a number of RTOs and ISOs across the country that provide funding to their equivalent of the BOSR. Examples include MISO's Organization of MISO States, SPP's Regional State Committee, and PJM's Organization of PJM States. That list is not exhaustive, though. Another example is within the context of ISO New England. The New England States Committee on Electricity is also funded by that ISO. What I think I'll do now is go ahead and just wrap up my comments. You can skip two slides ahead to slide 7, please. And just to conclude things, I wanted to note that the public interest organizations, although we didn't weigh in on issue 4, we did weigh in on issue 5 regarding the guiding principles for the GRC's work, and we believe that the list that was provided that guided the transitional committee's work is a really great starting point, but that there are additional guiding principles that can and should be added to continue providing guideposts as the GRC is finalizing a governance proposal for EIM and EDAM governance going forward. I am not going to read all of these principles, but what I will say is that anything that is that has been highlighted in red is new language that we have added to the existing guiding principles that were provided in the scoping paper. And if you want to transition to slide 8, you can see the remaining guiding principles that we are suggesting. And with that, I will go ahead and wrap up my initial comments. Thank you so much for the time, and I look forward to our panel discussion.
Perfect. Thank you, Jennifer. And thank you to all the panelists. I think that was I really appreciate the overview that each of you provided, and I think you can start to see the diversity and the similarities in the comments that have been received. I'm going to turn now to the Governance Review Committee and give the Governance Review Committee members a chance to ask clarifying questions on the content of what you've just heard from any of the panelists. If you have any kind of questions for clarification before we transition into discussion by topic area. And so I think all the Governance Review Committee members are on open line. You don't need to signal that you want to ask a question. You just can step in and ask a question if you have one. Okay, so no clarifying questions. So here's where we're going to transition. So for those of you on the phone kind of listening and hearing all of this, we're going to now ask Rebecca Wagner. She's going to moderate a discussion on the issue of delegation of authority. So she's got a couple of questions that she'll start asking with the panelists, but we also invite stakeholders to ask your questions. And so Rebecca will kind of turn and give you a chance to ask questions. Also, GRC members, you are going to have a chance to ask additional questions as well. So I'll turn it over to Rebecca now, and we're going to focus in on conversation on delegation of authority.
Thanks, Therese. I appreciate everybody who has joined the call, from stakeholders to our panelists. Like Therese said, I wish we could be meeting in person, but This is the next best option. So thank you all for taking the time and paying attention for several hours today. I'm impressed by that dedication because I know I struggle. I'm going to just go through the order in which we've already received the presentations. And I have a series of questions about the delegation of authority as it was described in the scoping paper. And our intent is to elicit some more fine-tuned responses and provide the panelists an opportunity to go a little deeper into their comments that they have filed. And then I will ask the GRC if they have any questions, then I'll transition to stakeholders and then back to GRC so that we can build, I don't want to say a robust record. I'm still recovering as a regulator for the most part, but just making sure that we cover as much as possible because there's been a lot of detail and we have a pretty big task ahead of us. So with that, I'm going to turn to Josh and Dave Rubin. And I'd like you two to start with what considerations or factors do you think are important in the approach to delegation of authority? And it would be helpful if you identify yourself when you speak, just so that everybody knows who's speaking. So I'll turn it over to you, gentlemen.
Hi, Rebecca. Sure. This is Josh Walter. Thank you for the question. And this answer may actually help answer a couple additional questions. But one of the one of our guiding principles when developing our straw proposal was to ensure we did not create a need to reform California law in the process, and therefore have EDAM bump up against the same political obstacles that have confronted more formal regionalization efforts. So working within the proven delegated authority model, a second principle was how to maximize the authority of an independent EIM governing body. During our discussions, the EIM entities considered a joint authority model. We went with our recommendation for two primary reasons. First, vesting the EIM governing body with primary oversight of the real-time and day-ahead market, if EDAM is implemented, is consistent with the goal of maximizing their authority. Second, a dual authority model potentially changes the dynamic from a structure whereby both the EIM governing body and the EIM Board of Governors represent the market as a whole to one where the EIM Board of Governors would appear to represent the interests of California, of the California ISO Balancing Authority and the EIM governing body. And the EIM governing body would represent the interests of the other balancing authority. Potentially, this could be a more divisive approach. We recognize that a joint authority model could be crafted, but it involves a host of downstream complications. The EIM entities believe the GRC should evaluate different approaches to the delegation versus shared decision-making authority, but believe it's imperative that in evaluating different models, the GRC reviews and understands that by making a change in the decisional model, there could be and will be consequences in other aspects of the review process. As an example, let's say under a shared model, selection of members of the governing body becomes an issue. It becomes a basic issue of numbers, 5 from the Board of Governors representing California, and any given number of members on the governing body could also have a background in California. For market participants that fall outside of California, this could be an issue associated with fair representation and an issue for achieving a high enough level of independence to meet the need of the expanding market. That's all I have for that. Thanks, Josh.
It's awkward on the phone. Can't take visual cues. But David, did you want to? Did you have anything to add to that?
Not much. I really appreciated sort of the way Josh approached it. I do sort of want to stress how much consistency there is, even though I think on the surface it looks like there's some significant differences between the shared authority model that we have put forward with, let's say, the joint approach that PG&E did. And by that, I mean there's a lot of agreement on how the shared approach should work in terms of what is shared, that there is that category of retained primary California Board of Governor authority over transmission planning, interconnection, resource adequacy. So the division that, PG&E described is very consistent with the, division we tried to describe, and we certainly agree you could go section by section through the tariff and identify how that breaks down. As Josh indicated, to us the real question on joint is, you know, whether or not we're really going to continue with a paradigm where the EIM governing body is representing the market as a whole, including the California participants, with the knowledge that, you know, the California Board of Governors would always have, as Jennifer described it, that ability to, pull an item from the consent agenda, recognizing that FERC is sort of the ultimate arbiter here of just and reasonable under the tariff. But what we were a little bit concerned about when we looked at a joint paradigm is, if it's truly joint, you're really setting it up where the ISO Board of Governors is the defender of the California BAA, and you're sort of shifting potentially the role of the EIM governing body to be the defenders of the non-California BAAs, because otherwise, why does each one, it's sort of, what is the jurisdiction of each body in that joint authority model? And while it's worked well in sort of the consensus regime we've been in to date, it really becomes more challenging if the market is ever under a stressful kind of a condition. And that's why I think we came down on the recommendation we did. That having been said, we certainly recognize that the joint authority model put forward in some of the comments here is a significant step forward from the status quo.
Thanks, David. I'm going to transition to our next question. Would it be helpful for the GRC to explore or consider two different delegation of authority models?
And I think basically both Josh and I would say yes, that you know, I think both the primary model that we put forward and the joint one are absolutely worth the board's consideration.
Yeah, I agree. I this is Josh, and I believe that, you know, that this is a great example for the deliberative process the GRC will be working through, right, is evaluating the pros and cons for these different delegation of authority models. You know, and as mentioned before, there, you know, a change in one model or considerations in one model may affect other issues, other downstream issues that just require careful consideration.
This is Matt Ricard. Can I take a turn here just to respond to a couple things?
Hold on, Josh, or Matt, hold on 1 second. I want to ask a follow-up question to Josh and David. You talked about other downstream issues. Have you identified these or just kind of have a general sense of what they would be? I'm just curious. I'm trying to think from your comments, and I'm, like, drawing a blank right now. So maybe a couple of examples of the downstream issues, and I think you raised a couple of them first, Josh.
And I think I'll take a quick shot, Josh, and either correct or elaborate. But one of them, obviously, is sort of the dispute resolution process. And so under any regime, whether one has primary or whether you go to a purely joint, you're going to want to have a process of what happens if the boards don't agree and ultimately how to divide up, you know, whether an initiative just doesn't go forward to FERC and people still retain a 206 right, or whether you get into a situation where you may have two 205 filings that go to FERC simultaneously. ISO New England has that as an element of their tariff, where you end up with a jump ball and FERC makes an ultimate call as to which of the two proposals to go forward with. So one of the things to think through in terms of any change in delegated authority is how you handle that dispute resolution process.
Okay, and that's certainly a topic we covered in the transitional committee. I just remembered the initiated memory of the dual 205 filings, and that dynamic is awkward. Matt, I'm going to give you a chance to respond, but you're going to be up next anyway. So let me check with the GRC members to see if they have any questions for the Josh and David right now. So GRC members, any questions?
Hi, Rebecca. This is Tony. I have a question that I'm not sure it's for Josh or David, but I want to, I think one of the obvious things that comes up, and I maybe just want to add it to our to-do list or see if Roger has any opinions at this juncture in time, but whether there are any considerations that we need to take into account if we were to explore a joint model just based on legal principles of corporate governance, what would the joint model need to look like and not run afoul whatever the basic corporate obligations of the ISO Board of Governors are? That's a sort of a question in my mind. And Roger, I don't know if it's appropriate to opine on that right now, but it seems like an obvious question that we'll have to explore.
Yeah, well, certainly, Dan and Bert have been doing a lot of thinking on this. So, why don't I, instead of trying to interpret what Dan might be doing, why don't I ask Dan to comment? Dan Chonkweller.
Sure. Hey, Tony. There, in terms of legal limits on a or principles that might apply to a joint authority decision-making structure, there is a relevant California law. It's Section 5210 of the California Corporations Code, and that's the section that says that the board must have responsibility and is responsible for all activities of the corporation. Now, we think that does probably impose some limits and restrictions on a joint authority model and on some of the things being proposed and discussed here. It's hard to apply on the fly, so it's something we'd have to consider. There's not a lot of authority, but it would take a detailed model to sort of begin to analyze that. But it's something we'd have to keep in mind.
Yep. Okay. Thank you very much.
Other GRC members, questions? Okay, and Therese, I'm going to ask you, do you want me to open it up to stakeholder questions now or hold those till the end?
Yes, I would go ahead and let, because I think you're going panelist by panelist, so this might be a good time to let stakeholders ask questions of Josh and David specifically on their presentation and their comments so far.
Okay. And Matt, do you want to hold yours until you do your presentation or you answer questions, or do you want to be our first stakeholder?
I'll hold. That's fine.
Okay, cool. I appreciate that. So opening it up for stakeholders.
Are there instructions on the phone lines? Do they have to?
Yes, if they have a comment or a question, you must hit 1, then 0. So, again, any questions or comments, please press 1, 0. At this time, there's nobody in queue.
Okay. Great. Then let's transition to Matt LaCar and turn it to you, Matt. But let me first pose the same questions, and then you can incorporate what you heard and the feedback you want to give to Josh and David's comments. From PG&E's perspective, what considerations or factors do you think are important to the approach to a delegation of authority? And then additionally, what is the ideal representation, if there is a joint authority model, what is the ideal representation under that paradigm?
Okay, so I think as far as the delegation of authority, you know, the previous speakers rightly identified, you know, there is a constraint that comes from the current statutory authority given to the CAISO board by the state of California. So I would argue that the distinction, you know, in a joint or shared governance model between the authority vested in the two bodies or two boards is not a question of geographic representation, but one of state sovereignty. So the California board, you know, California built an institution. California ratepayers, consumers paid the cost of building it up over the last 20 years. It is our balancing authority governance. And while the shared market is voluntary for everyone else, it's not voluntary for us. We are lending you the use of our mandatory FERC jurisdictional ISO. And so just as that raises all kinds of state sovereignty questions for each of the EIM participating entities outside of California, it raises sovereignty questions for California. You know, if we come to a crisis, if things go south, if members start to withdraw voluntarily their balancing areas from the EDAM, what rights does California have? So I think that's part of the downstream consequences that come with a delegation of California authority. So I think our position remains that the 205 rights that are vested with the California ISO Board of Governors today should remain exclusively with the California ISO Board of Governors. That's probably the limit to which you can push the voluntary market and the voluntary participation concept of shared governance. So I see a link between sort of the voluntary nature of EDAM participation, you know, 180 days exit with no exit fees, right? From that standpoint, the delegation and the use of consent agenda approval by the California board remain necessary as long as EDAM is a easy in, easy out, voluntary shared market. I think some of the proposals that you're hearing, you know, hint towards perhaps an evolution that could occur over time, especially if you have a, you know, stable membership of, say, a population of states that are currently in EIM, you know, over several years, continuing in EDAM with nobody leaving, as it's been the case in EIM, you know, then I think it's appropriate to talk about, hey, can we, you know, push this forward to the next state of shared investment and perhaps, you know, shared institution building. But for the moment, you know, the California ISO has California in its name for a reason. It's not voluntary for those of us who are within the balancing authority area. I think that remains for us probably the ultimate backstop is, you know, what if all five of the California governors disapprove of something and all of the EIM governing body members approve it, what do we do? And that was the dispute resolution question. You know, we've actually put forward a joint approval model that, you know, skews the numbers So, you know, you could be in a situation where the shared market governance, I'll call it the EIM governing body today, you know, overrides the view of all five California Board of Governors members. I would not ever expect that to be the case. And if it were, you know, then the question of does California as a balancing area and as a participant in a voluntary market want to stay in that voluntary market, right? And that's where, you know, pulling something off the consent agenda is kind of the nuclear option. So I'll leave it there. I don't think it's valuable to sort of flesh out all of these contingency scenarios of dire straits, but, you know, governance exists, and to protect each participant and secure the sovereignty, assure the ultimate sovereignty of each participant. And in the case of California, because we are lending our balancing area institutions and our balancing area governance to this shared market, I think it's appropriate to think about, you know, what it is we are delegating, right? We're delegating our sovereignty to a shared governance. I'll stop there.
Thanks, Matt. I'll turn to the GRC for any questions.
This is Therese. I have a question for Matt that actually also may go back to David Rubin, because I think David had made the reference that he thought there were similarities between what was in Matt's presentation about bright line and joint approval and what the EIM entities were looking at. And so I'd like to understand better, Matt, when I heard your presentation and look at your slides, I read the bright line, if I'm reading this right, am I understanding if you would give the EIM governing body primary authority over real-time market design, not day-ahead market design, but real-time market design?
And I guess that's open for discussion. I was preserving, this is Matt again, just on that point, it's an open question to my mind, you know, how distinct EIM as a real-time-only institution remains. So it may depend also on how elaborately intertwined the EDAM rules become with the EIM rules today. So, you know, we continue to think of these as separate markets with separate institutions because today the day-ahead market is only available to the balancing area participants and, you know, financial actors and so forth. But the reality is once you create these EDAM market structures, there will be obligations that carry forward from day-ahead into real-time. There will be, you know, data and assumptions about resource participation that carry forward. So one scenario is you have an EIM with a separate footprint or, you know, a subset of the footprint that remains a real-time-only market for those who want a real-time-only market, in which case today's EIM governing body rules make sense and should continue as they are. So that's what I was preserving some space for. If in the development of the EDAM rules, you know, it becomes clear that separate real-time-only market space no longer exists as a distinct possibility, and that, you know, it is all EDAM from day ahead through to real-time, then, you know, perhaps that division of the authority goes away and you simply have either CAISO balancing area governance or shared EDAM governance. So that third bucket that I was, or classification that I was preserving, would be the section of the tariff that deals only with today's EIM.
Thank you. That's helpful. David Rubin, do you have any comment on where you
where we would draw
similarity?
The line? sure.
Yeah,
I mean,
saw similarity or difference.
I mean, the similarity certainly for us is the other parts of the tariff that would remain with the ISO Board of Governors' primary authority, and that that would never be challenged. Things, as I said, Section 40 of the tariff on resource adequacy, other sections dealing with transmission planning, interconnection. For us, if we remain only in an EIM state, we would propose that the EIM governing body have primary authority over the real-time market. If we transition to an EDAM, we would certainly want the EIM governing body to have primary authority over both the day-ahead and the real-time. And I do agree with Matt in the sense that I think if we are in an EDAM market, that there is just, you have to look at it holistically, that there will be a relationship between the rules and the resource efficiency tests and the transmission availability and all of those other aspects of the day-ahead market that would, you know, require us to have sort of a conforming process through the EIM. So I think the EDAM requires it to be both. I think that our proposal is if there isn't an EDAM, we should still go ahead and seek the maximum authority for the independent governing body for the EIM.
Thank you, David. And just one last follow-up, if I can, Rebecca. And then, David, just to kind of link to Matt's comments, in that primary authority for the governing body that still assumes, right, that all decisions go on the consent agenda for the ISO Board of Governors and that they would have the ability to pull it off the consent agenda and reject anything if it was not acceptable to the ISO Board of Governors.
Correct. And again, that gets into the description of California law that I think Roger and Daniel put forward, which is, you know, California is always going to have that, what I'll call sort of backstop. And I guess I would sort of challenge a couple of points that Matt made, because I don't think they're really lending us the market. We're paying the GMC, we're contributing to the functions that we are participating in. The other part of it is, I think, you know, the notion of it voluntary and easy in an easy ad. I think if I guess what will happen at the RIF this afternoon, because it's been the case with a lot of the EIM entities that have, planned on joining more recently, is that the formation and expansion of these markets have a fundamental effect on the bilateral market, and that it really becomes much more of the trading through the organized market and sort of a drying up of the liquidity on the bilateral. And it really is, if we're really going to do an EDAM and we're going to have the robust participation to make it effective, then we really should plan for it to be that way, and we should have the governance that supports it. And that's where we were coming from.
Thank you.
GRC members, any questions for Matt or any follow-up on the discussion so far? And Matt, I want to give you the opportunity to, do you want to respond to any of that discussion, or?
I don't know that I need to respond directly. It's an interesting thought experiment to say, you know, if the result of EDAM formation and success in recruiting membership is, you know, the disappearance or diminishment of bilateral opportunities outside of EDAM, that starts to look an awful lot like a West-wide RTO. And, you know, I certainly would be the last to get in the way of, you know, an evolution of EDAM towards that objective. But, you know, I think we're still at a formation stage where none of those outcomes are certain. So, you know, I was looking through a sovereignty lens more than a geographic lens to say, this is a California institution that others are interested to join on a voluntary basis. It's not voluntary for California. And so the, you know, once again, the delegation of authority with the consent agenda and, you know, the overhang of California in the name really stems back to the voluntary nature of participation. If it becomes mandatory, if there's no more bilateral world, then we need to talk, right? But we're not there yet. The other thing I wanted to mention was, you know, we haven't really talked about the classification piece of it. So I just want to underline that the but-for test that we have today in EIM for individual initiatives as they're proposed really doesn't work with EDAM. There is no ISO market without the day-ahead market. And so, you know, it's hard to say what initiative would exist but for EDAM, because there is no alternative to a day-ahead market. It is where we do all our transactions. So I'll leave it at that. But, I think the bright line test is it's hard to come up with a different way of classifying initiatives once we get to EDAM.
Okay. Thanks for that. Can we open it up for the line for stakeholder questions now, please?
Certainly. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions or comments, please press 1, then 0. Again, 1, then 0 if you have any questions or comments. At this time, there is no one in queue.
Okay, thank you. And thanks, Matt. Let's turn to Commissioner Taney from the Oregon Commission. I'd like to hear from you and the BOSTER perspective on what considerations or factors do you think are important in the approach to the delegation of authority.
Thank you so much. I've really appreciated the exchange so far on this question. It's very helpful to understand the nuances and constraints. The BOSTER supports, of course, the continued expansion of the governing body's authority. The approach of moving towards shared authority incrementally, adding to what is a currently very complex framework, we were concerned has the potential to lead to procedural conflicts and unexpected outcomes. So aside from the points that Mr. LaCar pointed to around how you would determine a but-for test, in general, the subjective tests don't help transparently establish the independence of the governing body. The difficulty in explaining and the subjective nature don't help tell the story. We would really prefer a simplified governance structure that shares the decisional authority appropriately on all matters affecting the EIM. And I'd reflect, we need to be able to explain that authority to other decision makers in our states in a way that builds confidence. And building on the point about a market that is resilient in the face of shocks and stress, we as decision makers in our states need to be able to articulate to other policymakers and decision makers in our state who hold us accountable for customer impacts and state policy impacts how the authority structure works in the construct of a shock or a crisis. And I reflect as well, this is a space where as the BOSTER, we struggle to engage in the deep nuance as our individual commissions. And following the very important and very detailed pros and cons that I look forward to seeing fleshed out in this deliberative process is a real challenge for us as stakeholders. And then reflecting that process back into our states so that there is confidence in how this is moving forward at the policymaker level is similarly challenging. So I appreciate venues like this where we can understand better the back and forth, but I'd also point to the link to stakeholder processes and the need for time and resource to engage and wrestle these issues to the ground, even though we are not as perhaps as deeply expert in all of the ins and outs as the market participants are demonstrating that they are. So I appreciate your patience with us as we get to grips with this complexity. And for me, this argues for the transparency, the simplicity, and the way those feed into resilience over time as the West gets to grips with what this sharing of authority really means at home.
Thank you, Commissioner. That's helpful feedback and appreciate the position you're in. There's a lot to grapple with. GRC questions for Commissioner Tonin. Everybody's chicken to ask the commissioner a question.
This commissioner is always open for questions, please.
Hi, Rebecca. It's Tony. I was partly checking and partly delayed at hitting my mute button. Commissioner, so in your materials, you used the term public interest, and in listening to you speak this morning, it seemed to me that you're using that term broadly in the context of, you know, beneficial impacts in, for consumers, societal interest at large, et cetera. But, of course, that has a special meaning within, you know, groups or, you know, defined stakeholder sectors. And so I was wondering if you could articulate a little bit and clarify what you were speaking of when you're using those terms.
When we as the BOSR are working through our consensus process, I think we find ourselves where we find consensus is when we are operating at that public interest, as you were describing in the broader sense, level. In that consensus process, while the Oregon stakeholders or Oregon economic interests may have a particular view, in the BOSR, I can reflect that view, but we will not find consensus or not be able to express consensus reflecting only that Oregon economic view. Where there are common interests around the larger public goods is where the BOSR can find consensus and reflect it back to the market. And so that means that I think you see this similarly playing out in my conversations with colleagues in the RSC and in OMS. And in the history of OMS, you see this playing out in that articulating or advocating exclusively for Oregon's interests, for example, will limit the degree to which the BOSR can articulate any consensus out to stakeholders. It will... And where those interests where I have to, as an Oregon commissioner, really firmly stick to this is uncomfortable for Oregon, then the BOSTER can't articulate consensus. And so I think it's a natural process of the States Committee. It's a natural outcome of the States Committee process that you find the expressed positions very importantly articulating where there's alignment, and that alignment tends to be around the larger efficiencies, the larger questions of sovereignty, the larger questions of public interest. If I want Oregon's policies to be respected, then I need to advocate that Wyoming's policies are similarly respected, even if our two state legislatures have very different views on what the energy future might look like. And that consensus comes through in the BOSTER's positions, I think. And I think you see that in our peer organizations and how they've worked over time. I think the second part of your question points to a conversation that is more centered in the stakeholder engagement part of our dialogue this morning. And there, I think, when market participants have a profit motive, whether they're nonprofit or for-profit, they are using their generating assets to generate a profit on behalf of those who own those assets. I think there is a public interest about who is impacted in that process that also needs to be at the table. But we can talk about that more in the stakeholder conversation. I think that the second half of that question perhaps resides more firmly there.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'm mindful of time, and I'm going to probably go over our time because we still need to hear from Leah and Jennifer. And this delegation of authority is the heart of every what we're discussing. And not that the other factors or other issues aren't important, but I think we're getting a really robust conversation. I'll turn it to, if there are any stakeholder questions for the commissioner, can we open up the line?
Again, please press 1, then 0 if your questions or comments. At this time, there is no one in queue.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. Appreciate your comments. Now I'll turn to Leah Fisher from PGP. I'm screwing up my acronyms today already. And Leah, you've heard the questions that I've posed. You've had the opportunity to hear the dialogue. So I think, you know, why don't you just cover the points that or respond to anything and address any questions, you know, as I've posed already relating to what are the considerations or factors? Should we explore two different delegation models? And what is the ideal representation under a joint authority model? So I'll turn it over to you to tackle that in any way you want to.
Sure. Thanks, Rebecca. So, yeah, maybe I'll start with the considerations or factors that we've been considering in the approach to delegation of authority. So, first and foremost, we believe it really is essential to consider what is the maximum independence possible under existing California law, similar to what you heard from the EIM entities. All ISOs and RTOs operate with independent oversight of their markets, and while we recognize that EIM and EDAM does not constitute the development of an RTO or an ISO, we do think the broad impact and geographic scope of these markets make it essential to reflect the interests of all stakeholders, and we think this can be best done through independent oversight. In addition, we think it's also important to consider what delegation of authority will best reflect the interests of the entire footprint. Again, EDAM scope is broad, and it will impact both market participants in the footprint and those who do not participate in the footprint. So we think the delegation of authority should be designed to best represent the interests of all footprint stakeholders.
Another factor we think should be considered is what delegated model avoids the appearance of one party having more control or deference. And in thinking about this, we considered FERC's landmark Order 2000, which states that independence is the bedrock principle on which an RTO must be built and requires an RTO's governance structure to be independent in both reality but also perception. So if there's a perception that one class of stakeholders has more control or deference, this could really impact confidence in the EDAM and decrease its chances of success. So we think that should be considered. And lastly, we think it's really important to consider how you can ensure the delegation of authority is durable and can withstand disputes and challenges. And so in considering all of these, where we landed is that we think the best way to achieve maximum independence is to have the primary authority over the day-ahead market and real-time market go to the independent governing body. So in thinking about this, you know, why the primary authority versus joint authority is more appropriate, we just think that the perception of a joint authority model is that one class of participants, California interests, could have more influence than other stakeholders because they're represented by the CAISO board instead of being on an equal footing as other stakeholders represented under the independent governing body. And we also think there's some complexities with the joint authority model because it would require discussion of how many members from inside and outside the borders of California should be involved in that independent governing body to balance weight there. And so in thinking about primary authority over joint authority, again, we think another reason that primary authority is more appropriate is because it focuses the deliberation of issues to the independent governing body forum. And this includes participants across the entire footprint. And we think deliberation of market rules with all market participants that will be impacted is really important, and it's less clear how that would happen under a joint authority model. And then finally, we just think under either model, it will be really important to have a robust dispute resolution process established to address instances where there could be CAISO board and independent governing body not in alignment. And so, getting to the second question, would it be helpful for the GRC to explore or consider two different delegation authority models? Absolutely. We definitely support the GRC doing a deep dive on both primary authority over day-ahead and day-ahead market and joint authority. We think the details really matter, and there are a lot of details to consider, like geographic representation, voting rules, how the deliberation of issues would occur, how dispute resolution would work, and that these really need to be explored and could help clarify some of the pros and cons of each approach that maybe we haven't thought of yet today. And so I think I will pause there, but if you want me to address the ideal representation, I can do that too.
Let's see if there are any GRC member questions.
Hi, Rebecca. It's Eric Eisenman. Leah, thank you very much for your presentation and your comments. And I'm kind of struggling with the delegation of authority and how do we thread the needle here. So I understand the rationale for your recommendation on the primary authority. The distinction I have I'm on the GRC, but I do work for PG&E, and for PG&E and Edison and San Diego Gas and Electric, the distinction is that, and I'm looking at your slide 3, we cannot withdraw from the day-ahead market. We are part of the CAISO balancing authority. We're a participating transmission owner. We can't withdraw period. There's an exception to that, but it's not going to happen. So I'm struggling with giving primary authority over the day-ahead market to the governing body. We're talking for the California consumers who are customers of the three big utilities, billions and billions of dollars per year without an ability to withdraw. So I'm kind of struggling at this point, I can't be supportive of turning over the primary authority of the day-ahead market to an independent governing body. So that wasn't really a question, but if you have a reaction to my comments, I'd be interested in that. I want to hear from you and other presenters. There's been other conversation on this, and also from my fellow committee members on,
I can definitely offer some thoughts on that, and I appreciate that question. I think it's a good one, and it's carefully considered. So I think one thing to share, so in considering the independent governing body and that role and the representation, we think that the independent governing body would represent not only the interests of the day-ahead market and real-time market footprint and interests outside of the CAISO BAA, but it would also include and represent the interests of the CAISO BAA itself. So because the independent governing body represents the interests of not only stakeholders outside of California, but also the interests of California LSCs, we think joint authority isn't necessary to protect the California LSCs' interests. We think that the primary authority can, and we think the independent governing body can also equally represent California interests. And I guess another question, in thinking about sort of the question about voluntary versus not voluntary and that kind of nuance for California participants and not being, they don't have voluntary participation. And I understand that point. But I guess we've been struggling with, you know, why the primary authority where you have the sort of kind of backstop ability to pull something off the consent agenda, the CAISO board has the ability to pull something off the consent agenda, why that wouldn't be sort of the best protection and solution for those mandatory participants, why the joint authority model is viewed as somehow providing more protection there. Because for us, it seems like the primary authority where you have that kind of backstop ability to pull something off the consent agenda would actually provide better protection. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, because that's the way we've been thinking about it and questioning that kind of perspective.
Yeah, I recognize the ability of the CAISO board to pull something off the consent agenda that exists now and you know could be the status quo. And you used the word protection, and I get that, and that does provide some protection. To me, it's just not ideal to have primary authority of a governing body and then the ISO board to say, no, you can't do that. And that rubs me the wrong way. So we have to all figure out how to thread that needle. So I really appreciate your comments and the thought that you've given to this. If anybody else has any feedback on the discussion Lee and I just had, I'd appreciate hearing that either now or offline or with my fellow committee members. Thanks.
Any other GRC questions or responses to what Eric just posed?
Hey, Rebecca, it's Tony. Just a quick observation. This issue is obviously at the heart of a lot of the comments that we've gotten, so we're going to have to carefully plot our next steps on this. This consent agenda versus affirmative role comes up in quite a few stakeholder comments. I do think there's a way to thread this needle, but it's obviously going to be one of our main charges.
Yeah, I see the formation of our workload growing as we go through these conversations, and it's really good to hear these perspectives. I'll open for questions to stakeholders on the line, mindful of the fact that we just have a couple of more minutes, and I want to give Jennifer her fair share of time as well.
And again, if you have any comments or questions, please press 1, then 0. And we do have a comment from the line of Beverly Barrington. Please go ahead.
This is Beverly Barrington speaking, Southern California Edison. Thank you all for your presentations this morning. I've been sitting listening here to all the comments and questions that have been asked, and I find it hard to reconcile how an independent governing body will be able to to examine real-time and day-ahead issues, given that you have one BAA that has mandatory requirements of participation in the markets, and the other BAAs are of a voluntary nature, their participation is of a voluntary nature, but yet at the same time, there is a clause in one of the presentations that should any participant decide to withdraw from the market, they should be able to exit without any exit fees. So I'm wondering, how do you put together all these ideas to come up with any sort of objective outlook about decisions with respect to market design, equitable distribution of diversity benefits? I would like to hear, you know, people to respond to those types of things. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. Leah, do you want to tackle that?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a balance, right? So it's not just getting to delegation of authority and what the answer is there. I think it's a whole package of governance changes and how those can best reflect the different interests. Of course, you know, we do have that dynamic. It's real that certain participants have mandatory participation and others don't. And so how do you balance that? And so I think that can be reflected in considering the interests we're trying to achieve and represent and going through the various governance changes that are under consideration. So I don't think there's one, you know, specific approach on delegation or other issues that's going to kind of probably thread that needle or meet that need. But I think it's real, and I agree that we need to think about how to best consider that as we're going through this suite of governance changes. And yeah, so that would be how I consider that.
Thanks, Leah. And that's the questions raised by Beverly are, you know, foundational to what the GRC will need to consider. So I'm glad that you raised those questions, and that adds to our deliberation and discussion when we get to the point of trying to narrow this down and take in all points of view. With that, I'm going to turn to Jennifer Gardner. Jennifer, I'm sorry to put you last in with just a few minutes. You can answer the questions I've posed, respond to other comments, make something new up for us to consider and complicate it. But I'll turn it over to you on how you want to respond.
Yeah, you know, I think I'll just keep my comments really, really short, Rebecca. You know, I've already kind of laid out the two options that public interest organizations are presenting as different approaches to this delegated authority model that might be, I guess, more effective and more representative of this market as it continues to grow and potentially add services through the EDAM. So I'm not going to explain those two options again because I already did that. But just a couple of maybe clarifying points based on the discussion that we've already had here today. It sounds to me like there is some interest around a dual board or joint authority construct here, where we have the CAISO Board of Governors and the EIM governing body sharing authority over these different markets, while acknowledging that there are certain issues that are very specific to California that probably aren't appropriate within a shared authority model. Those issues have already been raised, for example, the transmission planning issue, the interconnection issue, as well as the resource adequacy in California issue. I think public interest organizations really like this idea of a dual board or shared authority model because we think it offers simplicity. We also like the fact that it can work without this consent agenda requirement that we currently have today within this primary versus secondary versus hybrid authority model that we work with. And I very much appreciate the comments that I think were raised by Bert earlier in the discussion regarding Section 5210 of the California Corporate Code, which of course requires the Board of Governors to ultimately be responsible for all activities of CAISO as a corporate entity. So I think what I'll do is just offer one additional remark and then open it up to questions. Assuming that there isn't general support for this shared authority model, and we find ways to increase durability, increase independence of the EIM governing body using the existing model that we have today, where we have primary and advisory authority, et cetera, I think there are other ways to create confidence in the independence of the EIM governing body. One option, which wasn't outlined in our comments, but has just kind of come to me as we've been having this discussion, when we use the consent agenda model for the CAISO Board of Governors, today, if something falls within the governing body's primary authority, the Board of Governors can remove that item from their consent agenda by a simple majority vote. If they were to do that, then they could technically reject that proposal and send it back to CAISO management to develop an entirely new proposal. And, you know, as was mentioned earlier, this offers sort of this protection that the CAISO Board of Governors can actually veto a decision of the governing body should it see the need to do so. One option for maybe making that veto authority maybe heightening the bar for that veto authority would be, rather than requiring a simple majority vote, would be to make that requirement unanimous, or perhaps require a supermajority vote. That would make it harder for the CAISO Board of Governors to undo decisions within the governing body's primary authority. That's just one example of a way that we could strengthen the existing model to give regional stakeholders more confidence in the independence of the governing body. But again, I think from public interest organizations' perspective, we really like this idea of this dual board or joint authority model. We think it's cleaner. We think it actually is the most representative of where things are going. So I will stop there with my initial remarks. I'm happy to take questions from GRC members or from other stakeholders. Thank you.
Thanks, Jennifer. Turning to GRC members, any questions for Jennifer?
This is Therese Hampton. I think I don't know if my question is for Jennifer or if it's for Roger. I have a question about whether a joint authority, if we know, whether joint authority could eliminate the need for the consent agenda process, or if there would, because I think I had understood in the way Matt had represented his perspective on joint authority that you would have the joint authority and there still would be a consent agenda process. And so I think I have this a legal question about whether 5210 would require just that last kind of consent agenda of the ISO Board of Governors.
Well, Roger stepped out for a moment, but Bert, he just stepped back in, and but Bert is here. I'll take a try at it. I'm not sure. I think that the key from the standpoint of board control is whether the board at some point, you know, by a majority vote, would be able to decide something. So I think it depends a lot in the joint authority context what that would mean. If the two bodies were completely melded together in a way that made it so that the individual members of the Board of Governors couldn't actually, you know, present a vote that was their own majority vote, that would be more problematic from the standpoint of eliminating their authority over the ultimate decisions than if you had a scenario that didn't have that. So I guess what I'm saying is I think it could be accomplished in a joint authority context. You could still maintain the board's authority in one way or another, but it would depend on the details.
Yeah, and this is Roger. I look at it, you know, similarly as how much can the board advocate its authority and what type of safety valve is in place, you know, quote unquote, around safety valve in order to satisfy the requirements under state law.
So this is Jennifer, and I apologize for stepping in here. I hope this is okay. But for CAISO Legal, just to follow up on Teresa's question, which is an excellent one, under the two examples that I provided in my earlier remarks where we see CAISO adopting this framework today, both within the EDAM stakeholder process and the GRC stakeholder process, I am assuming that the way that that's being construed today is that it's acceptable because we have two boards who are weighing in on the issue, and we are requiring that both boards provide majority approval for the tariff change. And so within the current framework, the joint authority model can work under California law. Is that correct?
I think I would agree with that.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay, just trying to wrap up. Let's open it up for any stakeholder questions for Jennifer. We can open up the line.
Any questions or comments, please press 1, then 0. Again, 1, then 0 for questions and comments. We have a question from the line of Beverly Barrington. Please go ahead.
Yes, this is Beverly Barrington again from Southern California Edison. I'm trying to understand Jennifer's proposal. Jennifer is trying to say that, okay, you can combine whatever the membership is on the governing body, the independent governing body, with whatever is the California Board of Governors as well. And based on the voting, determine whether or not an item on the agenda should be withdrawn. I find that difficult to accept because what that is saying is no longer is California independently determining whether or not something is important to its BAA, but there are other parties who have a say.
Beverly, thank you for that question, and I apologize if I was confusing in my remarks. I actually don't think I'm saying that. Just for purposes of a quick clarification, I threw out a couple of different ideas, and I think that's where it got confusing. The first point that I was trying to make is that, you know, public interest organizations see value in a joint authority construct going forward. A joint authority construct based on our comments is the situation in which we still have two boards. We have an independent governing body, whether you call it EIM or EDAM, doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. And then you still have a CAISO Board of Governors. And the idea here is that there are so many issues that would impact the decision-making authority of both boards that we, you know, in most cases, aside from certain California-specific exceptions, we would require a majority vote of both sitting boards. The other thing that you discussed was my point on the consent agenda, which the consent agenda is, of course, that protection that's being provided under the existing model where we have a primary authority versus advisory authority versus hybrid authority construct that's being mm-hmm. used between these two boards. So I'm not suggesting that the consent agenda would be used in conjunction with our proposal for a joint authority approach. So I should make sure that's clear, because I tend to agree with you that could be a very, very confusing and problematic. So I hope that answers your question.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay. And just a note for stakeholders on the phone, this is our first run at this. There's going to be ample opportunities to refine positions, offer thoughts. So this was a very helpful conversation, lots to think about, but clearly there'll be plenty more opportunity to engage. I'm going to turn it back to Therese, who will hopefully send us off to break for a few minutes.
Yes, I will. Thank you, Rebecca, for moderating that first panel. Thanks, everyone. We took some time on that because that really is a key issue. We're going to take a break until 10:30, and then we're going to come back. We have three other topic areas where we have questions set up with moderators, and then we will also open it up for other questions as well. So we're going to take a break till 10:30, and please come back and join us. And I am happy to hear some folks on the phone starting to ask questions. So those of you that are listening on the phone, we would like to get your involvement as well. So be thinking about questions when we come back at 10:30. Thanks so much.
Thank you for your patience. All lines are now connected.
Terrific. Thank you. This is Therese Hampton. Thank you to those on the phone. We apologize for the technical difficulties. I've often been accused as a facilitator of sometimes not giving people breaks, and there's a reason why, because it always takes a longer time to get back than you think it will. But thanks for staying with us, and we had a really good discussion this morning, and looking forward to continued moderated discussion of the issues. The next moderated discussion will be led by Suzanne Cooper from Bonneville Power, and on the issue of selection of the board. Suzanne.
Hey, thank you, Therese. Good morning, everybody. So I'm going to take a slightly a different approach than for the prior group that Rebecca facilitated, and I'm going to go question by question and then ask the panelists at each question point to collectively respond to the question for those who have interest in doing so. So the very first question. And you'll find, I think, that there are similarities or there may be some overlap in responses because we've had such a rich discussion so far. This first question is, what considerations or factors are important for the size of the EIM or future EDAM governing body? I think I'd first address that to Josh Walter or David Rubin from the EIM entities.
Hi, Suzanne. Thank you. This is Josh Walter with the EIM entities. In terms of both size and experience or expertise, the tenet of independence is one of the most important aspects of the size and makeup of the governing body. Additionally, fair representation on the governing body, where the function of the market comes first, is also incredibly important to the continuation of working towards what's made the EIM function so well over the past 6 years, and that of a well-functioning market that continues to provide benefits for participating entities and their customers. While the EIM entities don't have specific recommendations on the number to the size of the board, more generally, too large a board may result in increased turnover and a loss of valuable experience. And moreover, it may further complicate the ability of the EIM governing body members to attend meetings such as the RIF or have an opportunity to interact with other stakeholders. So that's, not a specific number, but maybe some consideration in determining kind of the makeup of the governing body. That's all I have.
Thank you, Josh. David, do you have anything to add?
No, Josh said it well, and that last point is one that maybe Roger or some of the other ISO attorneys could weigh in on, and it was we understood that there are sort of some open meeting restrictions on the number of people who can sort of get together without it being a notice meeting, and so we've certainly greatly appreciated the attendance of the EIM governing body meetings at other stakeholder events and the RIF, and think that that's a really valuable outreach that they've done.
Thank you. Matt LaCar, do you have any thoughts to offer with regard to the size of the governing body?
Only what I've said so far, which is, we would support a larger, more diverse governing body. I think no one is challenging the independence. I think that's a cornerstone, both for the governing body and, frankly, for the ISO board. They are, financially independent of any market participant. That's a requirement. I will say a different dimension of the selection and nominating committee's challenge is because of that independence, there is a limited pool of subject matter experts. Generally, we've been looking at folks who are either former regulators or retired from an industry position and no longer hold, you know, any vested stock in their former companies. You know, I would worry that, you know, if the board got too big, that we would just, you know, exhaust the pool of qualified candidates pretty quickly. That being said, you know, I think there's room to increase. We've certainly attracted very qualified folks so far. And, you know, one of the things we've learned from that, and I would love to hear, you know, maybe some of the governing body members or former governing body members that are present, you know, I think having the just the diversity of skill sets, diversity of experiences really helps their deliberations, you know, maybe as much in the private executive sessions as in the public, you know, when they do have a chance to drill down, you know, often with ISO staff present on, you know, some really thorny market design issues. I don't think that's going to decrease to any degree, and I think, you know, to the extent that we can attract governing body membership that expands the talents and experiences of that group, that will lead to better decision-making. So I don't know what the exact right number is. It probably needs to be an odd number since boards, you know, typically like to decide things by simple majority. That does pose a mathematical challenge in the joint approval model that I allude to in our comments, which is obviously any two odd numbers put together is going to be an even number on the joint body. I think there are various possible solutions to that, but, you know, I don't need to get into that here, just pointing out mathematically that's kind of unavoidable. You know, any number from 5, 7, 9, you know, makes sense to us, but, you know, at this point we think, you know, 5 is where we're at, and it's probably at the low end of what will work for the complexity and diversity of the potential EDAM footprint.
Okay, thank you. Do any of the GRC members have follow-up questions on this particular topic covered by this question?
So, Suzanne, this is Val Fong, and I just wanted to respond directly to something that Matt just said, which is, you know, like, what does a more diverse committee give you if you're, or governing body or whatever, if you're on it? And it does enrich the conversations amongst ourselves, but the other thing that it does provide is more from how stakeholders might look at it, more avenues to actually have a one-on-one discussion about specific issues that a stakeholder might be helpful would be daylighted to the ISO or to the rest of the governing body. I don't know if that makes any sense, but I think it has sort of a twofold purpose. Having a diverse governing body has a twofold purpose.
Thank you, Member Fong, that's, for offering that perspective. It's very helpful. Any other GRC members?
This is Angelina. I just also wanted to second what Val Fong just said, is that, yes, it is important to ensure the geographic representation and that there is access to the governing body, but also that there's enough diversity, and following up what Jennifer had mentioned before, allowing the public interest groups to participate more fully is also going to be beneficial. I just wanted to float one item and raise it in terms of longevity and consistency for the boards with the 3-year terms. Is it appropriate to also start thinking that maybe the 3-year term is short or too short, and we maybe need to look at potentially increasing the time length to 4 or 5 years, more in tune with other agencies, to ensure that continuity and not the constant issue of having to be renominated? Just a thought. But other than that, the diverse representation and having a deep West-wide participation into the EDAM, and EIM is, I think, beneficial for the market and beneficial for the organizations as well.
Thank you. That's another really good consideration for us to take into account. Are there any questions from stakeholders or on this question? I think you need to press 1, then 0 if you want to offer
something. I'm sorry, it's 1-0, yes, to ask a question or to make a comment. 1-0. And there is no one in queue at this time.
Okay, thank you. So the next couple of questions go to are about the nominating committee itself. So the first one is whether there are important issues in the operations of the nominating committee that GRC should be aware of or take into account. I think I'll start with Commissioner Taney on this one.
Thank you. I think when we observe the nominating committee, we take our engagement with that committee very seriously and think, as we've just heard, very deeply about the diversity of the final board and how it manages both expertise and regional diversity. We would support a change to the voting status for the representatives of public interest and consumer advocate groups on the nominating committee. And I think this goes back to our sense that they need the ability to participate in reasonable proportion to the market participants and states' confidence that decisions take constituencies across the West into account. There's no actual or perceived conflict of interest that applies to the representatives of public interest, and there's not really a reason given for their non-voting status and the current structure, and so we really support changing that voting status going forward for the nominating committee.
Thank you, Commissioner. Jennifer Gardner, I think you have some thoughts on that same topic.
Yeah, thank you, and I appreciate the comments offered by Commissioner Taney. I think I'm in a unique position here because I've also been on the nominating committee since its inception, and so I've had some experience with how the nominating committee works, how it reaches consensus, and, you know, from personal experience, I've got to say that the nominating committee process, I believe, is working very, very well. One of the comments I made during my presentation earlier was that, in practice, the nominating committee actually operates on a consensus of all of its members. And I realize that's different from the language that's included in the selection policy, because in the selection policy, we have this very clear, bright line drawn between voting members and non-voting members, and technically the requirement is that the nominating committee reach consensus of only those members who have a vote. And I already went through some of the reasoning that's been used in the past for the member of the EIM governing body sector and the member of the CAISO Board of Governors sector for not weighing in on these consensus-based decisions. And those have been tied to conflict of interest or perceived conflict of interest concerns, but also potential concerns surrounding undue influence given the role of that particular body in the EIM governance process overall. You know, those same concerns have not historically applied, nor do they currently apply, to the sector representative from the public interest and consumer advocate groups. And so
I think the suggestion here is to really clarify or codify, if you will, the existing practices of the nominating committee, which are working very well. There doesn't seem to be any overlying rationale provided for why this sector isn't given a vote. Let's just give them a vote because they're already participating in the process. They're already weighing in. We're simply clarifying a process that's already taking place today and, as I said, is working quite well. So I'll stop there. I'm sure there might be questions for me regarding this particular recommendation, and I'm happy to take those.
Thank you, Jennifer. Are there questions from the GRC for Jennifer or Commissioner Tawney with regards to operations of the nominating committee?
Hi, this is Tony. So, yes, I think it's a broader question. I think when the transitional committee created the structures as they're currently constituted, there was a underlying skin in the game concept that is reflected in some of the decisions that were made with respect to the nominating committee here. From the perspective of many in the commenters, I think you can see that reflected. And when you look at, and I think this would presage a discussion in if we were to consider formation of a stakeholder advisory committee also. So I think that the question is, how do you respond to the following argument, which is, when you look at the EIM entities, in aggregate, they have invested hundreds of millions of dollars in their own systems and time of personnel and things like that. And if you apply that to the California load-serving entities, you know, it's clearly in the billions to stand up and operate the ISO. How do you create an equivalency between that level of investment and commitment to, you know, an interest group that is, you know, targeted on a particular, could be a fairly discrete issue, whether it's a consumer issue, whether it's an environmental advocacy role or some other policy topic? How do you create that equivalency of interest between the considerable commitment of the market participants versus what could be a fairly narrow interest group?
Yeah, Tony, I really appreciate that question. And this issue of who really has skin in the game is an issue that comes up time and time again in various stakeholder processes, whether it's here, whether it's at other RTOs or at WEC. So I certainly appreciate the concerns, particularly coming from market participants, that to really have a voting role in such important decisions like this one, you really should have some skin in the game. Now, I'm going to disagree, obviously, and I'll give you some reasons why. Public interest organizations and consumer advocates, you know, you're right. We don't have a direct financial stake in the market like these other sectors who have a voting role. But that being said, we are able to provide enormous value in the stakeholder process despite lacking that financial stake. So I think that this is evidenced by the various leadership roles that representatives of public interest organizations and consumer advocates have been providing and currently provide on the nominating committee, the regional issues forum, as well as the governance review committee, and of course, our ongoing engagement in a number of CAISO stakeholder processes. In other words, we might not have the financial stake in the market process, but we show up and we do the work, and I think that is incredibly important and should not be overlooked when considering the ability or the right of these types of sector representatives to have a voting role in the governance process. I should also state that a number of public interest organizations or consumer advocates, I think it's easy to assume that they have very narrowly defined interests. But I think at the end of the day, our interests when it comes to the market are not so different from the interests of those stakeholder sectors who are participating in the market. In other words, we want to ensure that the market is functioning effectively, that there is no market manipulation, that resources are being appropriately treated and integrated in the market framework. And so from that perspective, I don't think that our interests are all that different. So, you know, I offer those remarks simply because we're not going to get around the fact that we don't have a financial stake in the market, but we also provide enormous value in the stakeholder process. And at the end of the day, we want to see this market working well, which I think aligns very well with the interests of market participants.
Hey, Jennifer, I would jump in there because I say that I agree with you that, you know, the role of several of the public interest sector representatives, obviously your role in the nominating committee, Carl's participation in the transitional committee has been invaluable, and the work product would not be as good as it otherwise is to this date. I also want to sort of give a flavor to this dichotomy between market participants and non-market participants. I don't think it's right to look at the views of the market participants as solely limited to the financial outcomes of the markets and whether they're making money in one particular time interval or another. I know in my day job, my clients are very focused on whether or not the markets allow them to fulfill their business role, and their business role is varied, right? They're owned by their customers. They have RPS, carbon, various other mandates, as well as the need to assure affordable rates. And so I don't want to leave the impression. I don't think it's right as we think through this issue to think about these things in terms of, well, you've just got market participants who are looking at their bottom line versus, you know, those that are bringing a broader perspective. I think it's more nuanced than that.
I appreciate that clarification, Tony. Thank you.
This is Commissioner Tani. Could I add to this conversation?
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. I appreciate both the issue that you're raising and the reflection that market participants are thinking in both the near term and the long term, absolutely, and are balancing a range of issues inherent in their business and in what it takes to deliver in their business. I think from my personal view, engaging as a decision maker, having the public interest at the table in a clear and defined way is an improvement over vague engagement, because outside the process can end up being quite disruptive. And I would rather continuing cultivation of the non-market stakeholder or non-market participant stakeholders in that structured way that makes it clear across the West that their voice is being heard, because the alternative is disruptive in state capitals and in state proceedings. And so I prefer productive engagement over what could end up being a less productive engagement that we might see in our home states. Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner, I think you just made the strongest argument. It's better to have people in the tent.
Thank you, Tony. Any other feedback or questions from GRC members? Okay, can we move to, the next question, which also has to do with the nominating committee, if it's if it's okay, maybe I'll do this question, and then we can open up for GRC members and stakeholders, because they're somewhat related. And Tony already kind of foreshadowed this, which is there's been in the feedback concepts of adding potentially new advisory committees to the governance structure. If new advisory committees are created, should they be represented on the nominating committee? Jennifer, would you like to take that question first?
Sure. So, I guess maybe if you don't mind, Susan, I'd like to ask just a clarifying question on the question, just to be difficult. So, when we talk about new advisory committees being created, and I think you just provided an example, so my apology if I missed it, but we're talking about this in the context of a member advisory committee or a stakeholder advisory committee, or perhaps even a committee formed specifically for public power, as was addressed in some earlier remarks. Is that right?
Yes, those are the types that have been proposed, yes.
Yep. Okay. And so my reaction to that is that we're going to end up with some overlap on the nominating committee, right? Because right now the nominating committee is, I think, doing a really excellent job of representing all stakeholder sectors. For example, public power is represented on the nominating committee. California participating transmission owners are, end users are, public interest, et cetera. If we were to create a more formal stakeholder advisory committee, like a SAC or a member advisory committee, a MAC, then depending on how you define that, you're likely going to create an overlap with existing stakeholder sectors that are represented on the nominating committee today. I don't think in any of the proposals that we've seen are we seeing this idea that there is a stakeholder sector that's not currently being represented, at least as it pertains to the nominating committee process. So my suggestion, at least at this early stage, would be that you consider the current framework of the nominating committee, the current stakeholder representation model on that committee. If gaps do in fact arise as we consider creating these more formal advisory committees down the road, then sure, let's address that and let's make sure that all stakeholder sectors are adequately represented. But my concern with automatically giving them a seat on the nominating committee is that we end up with duplicative representation that might be unfair in the nominating committee's decision-making process. So I'll just stop there, but thank you for the question.
Thank you, Jennifer. David Rubin or Josh Walter or both? Or neither, I suppose.
Well, hi, Suzanne. Go ahead, David.
Well, I was just going to basically say that I think Jennifer's approach is a fair one. That is, you don't want duplication, but if there is a gap, to go ahead then and fill it. If there is a sector that is identified as not being represented on it. I've had the opportunity to be on the nominating committee through sort of two selection cycles, and certainly do want to echo the point that Jennifer's made early on in her presentation and subsequently, that it really has been a consensus-driven process. And I think what it really has been an extremely thorough process and a cooperative one that has led to a consensus outcome. And as Jennifer said, the real focus throughout all of those discussions has been just trying to make the market work as best we can. And I think everybody with that common objective has really contributed to that process. And so we do not want to exclude anybody, and the conversations have really been supportive and guiding towards that objective.
Thank you. Do any of the GRC members have questions or follow-up questions on this?
It's 1-0 for any questions.
So,
no questions.
Okay. I guess I have one, actually, which would be, I completely understand and can appreciate the concept of overlap and not wanting to create duplication. There seems to me there might be different ways of not having that duplication occur if new advisory committees were created, which could be perhaps what do you think of the idea of perhaps advisory committee representative replace a sector representative? One example would be EIM entities as a sector, and if there were a member advisory committee. As a means for not having duplication, but having committee representation. Thoughts?
Yeah, so this is Jennifer. And I think, Suzanne, I think you're right. There are a number of different ways that this could potentially be handled. If there is a way to avoid duplication of representation on the nominating committee, then I think it's an option that should be considered. But my word of caution would be if we move to a model where, let's say, for example, we're just relying on a member advisory committee to form the nominating committee. As currently defined by some folks, this member advisory committee or market advisory committee would only involve limited stakeholder sectors, primarily market participants. So I would want to certainly avoid a model where only some sector representation is provided on the nominating committee, or in the alternative, where we end up with duplicative representation on the nominating committee. But if there is a way to integrate that model, that stakeholder advisory committee or MAC model, into the nominating committee process to avoid those two outcomes, then I think it could be appropriate.
Well, Suzanne, it's Dave Rubin. If I could piggyback on Jennifer's point, I guess a concern that I would have would be if the stakeholder committee includes, for example, PTOs in California and EIM entities, then you could, in effect, lose representation on the nominating committee if there's only one representative from that joint stakeholder committee, as opposed to having a separate EIM entity representative and a separate PTO representative the way we have on the nominating committee today. So, again, I think a note of caution before we restructure what I think has been working really well.
Okay, thank you. That was a good discussion. I appreciate everyone's participation and input on and ideas in these areas of selection of the governing body members and how the nominating committee works.
Thanks, Suzanne, for moderating that panel, and thanks to the panelists. We're a bit behind schedule, and we've got two more sessions to go. So I'm going to turn this over now to Rob Taylor from the Governance Review Committee to talk about stakeholder engagement. And Rob, I'm going to give you the challenge. this is a big topic, I think, with potentially a lot of perspectives, and see if we can kind of cover the topic in about 20 minutes or so.
Sure thing. I think we can do that. So thank you, and I appreciate everyone on the phone for taking the time to join us today, and thank everyone for their written comments. Based on those comments, we have a few questions that we want to sort of touch upon. The first, all-around stakeholder engagement, obviously. The first is what considerations or factors are important for the GRC to consider relative to advisory committees? And I think, Josh and David, if you want to start us off on this one, I'd appreciate it.
Sure, Rob. Thank you. This is Josh Walter with the EIM entity. And, you know, Tony kind of teed this up already in the previous discussion, but to put a more formal answer from the EIM entities, our SHRA proposal supports the formation of a new advisory committee, and we look forward to a discussion on the parameters and the role of that advisory committee in the overall decision-making process for the EDAM marketplace. In the SHRA proposal, we came down on the side of a member advisory committee for a couple reasons. First, as discussed, the skin in the game issue was a core principle, and in our minds, it's difficult to equate the interests of those that have invested millions of dollars and thousands of staff hours and is legally committed to join the market formally with those that have not. The equivalence of issues, interest, and importance is, maybe not to downplay that others have an important role, but it's just at a different level and at a different scale. Second, it's important to recognize what we propose in the white paper be in the and the role that they this committee structure would play. We're not proposing that the committee substitute any sort of stakeholder process, but really just augment or change it. We're not proposing that the committee have veto rights formally or informally or any design initiative unlike other RTO structures. This, we envision the committee will be an incremental augmentation and improvement to the current stakeholder process and not serve to eliminate opportunities for input by any market participant or interest group in stakeholder processes.
David, do you have anything to add to that?
Nope. We're good. Thanks, Rob.
Okay. Latha, does the BOSER have a view?
Thank you. I appreciate the question. I think what we struggle with in our own commissions and our own processes and what we struggle with as perhaps somewhat less expert engagement in the CAISO processes is finding ways to ensure less expert stakeholders can still engage in some meaning in meaningful ways. And so, you know, building off my prior comments, I think finding ensuring that this is that any proposal is additive and not artificially crowding out less expert stakeholders from the important conversations that need to happen to build regional consensus around important market decisions. So that's a tough balance to find. We struggle with it in our own processes, in our own commissions, but it's an element of ensuring that we continue to build trust throughout the states as the market grows and states find themselves more and more committed to the market footprint.
Thank you. Before I open it up to the GRC members, would any of the other panelists like to address that question or any of, or what they may have heard from their fellow panelists?
Sure. This is Leah Fisher. I can jump in on this question. So we believe it's really important to encourage stakeholders to work together and provide collective input to the independent governing body. So we think advisory committees really can help support this kind of collaboration and coordination across stakeholder groups. And they can also increase stakeholder confidence and buy-in of EDAM overall. And we also think that they can help increase consensus on market design issues. So, and then just in terms of kind of some of the discussion that's been had on, you know, whether a member advisory committee might be more appropriate or whether a stakeholder advisory committee might be more appropriate, we've recommended a stakeholder advisory committee, and I think probably the most concise way to reflect on why that might be more appropriate than a member advisory committee is just, I think, what Lisa Tani said in the earlier segment. It's just, it's better to have more people in the tent, and we think a member advisory committee would cut out a really large swath of stakeholder input that can be really important and beneficial to have and will be to the benefit of EDM overall.
Do any of the GRC members have questions related to this, additional questions?
And that's 1-0 for any questions.
This is Andy Campbell.
Go ahead, Andy.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, just a couple questions. I just want to love to hear just a little more about the added value of a kind of formal advisory committee as opposed to the status quo where there's certainly ability to informally collaborate. And then I did also just, continuing on Commissioner Tani's comments, and sort of the importance of having an independent governing board, I can imagine a scenario where a market advisory committee is really, really good at developing consensus around lots of things. And that's very positive, certainly in many ways, or maybe a consensus among the members in that group. I guess that's a question that was just addressed by Leah. But that could also potentially reduce the role of the governing body to the extent it sort of becomes more of a position of kind of at least feeling the pressure to kind of rubber stamp or go along with what the advisory committee is doing, and there could be less deliberation at the governing body level if all the deliberation migrates to the advisory group. So I'd be interested in comments on those things.
We do have a comment from the phones. Amy McNella, please go ahead.
Before we go to that comment, would any of the panels like to respond to Andy's questions there?
This is Leah. I think the only thing I would say there is just that we think a formal body can help create collaboration that wouldn't otherwise potentially happen just through the individual stakeholder process. So it's just that increased opportunity is where we see the value add for the formal input through a stakeholder advisory committee. And also, it can increase alignment among stakeholders and reduce the range of options for consideration.
This is Letha. I think you raise an important question and would go back to the transparency and perhaps the way we tend to frame it as regulators is we work from a record and everyone can see what that record is. And I think you would want to consider how that deliberation and advisory opinion was carried forward, how open were those deliberations, and how fulsome was that record, so that that didn't become a black box if deliberations migrated. What the right answer is I think something for the GRC to deliberate, but I would advocate for that transparency and opportunity to engage on positions so that decisions are made in an open way.
Okay. And there was a question from the phone as well.
Yes, Amy McNella? Your line is open. Do you have us on mute, Amy?
Yes, is that better? Can you hear me? Hello?
Yes, we can hear you. Go right ahead.
Sorry, we were having some problems with our phones here. I just wanted to comment that I support the distinction that was proposed between member and stakeholder. I think that, honestly, the impact of this process can't really be equivalent with a member-only focus in that respect. It has to be broadened to include stakeholders, and I think that that comes up against the structure of this as it's evolving and even as it exists today in terms of of CAISO as a California structured entity versus all the surrounding states, which are not California. So to me, as this process is advancing, that's even if that's not adopted right at this time, that's going to become critical. So I just wanted to chime in on that. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. If there's no other questions on that area.
Hey, Rob?
Yes.
Rob, this is Rebecca Wagner. I just, and this can be reserved for future comments, but what I'm trying to wrap my head around is, you know, what's missing in the current process that would be remedied by a stakeholder process or a formal stakeholder advisory committee or a member advisory committee? And I think I've heard that the notion of ability to collaborate more, isn't the onus on that on stakeholders generally? And how couldn't that occur without a stakeholder advisory committee? What I'm fearful of is creating super stakeholders, which I think the member advisory committee could be perceived that way. And at this point, all stakeholders are equal. So, you know, you don't have to respond right now, but I'd like to get more feedback on what's broken that needs to be fixed. Is it access to ISO staff? Is it trying to influence the governing body or the Board of Governors? I mean, what's not quite right now? That would be helpful to better understand the need for creating a committee.
Thanks, Rebecca. That's actually a really great question. In fact, it kind of leads into our second topic area, and I wonder if Matt would want to sort of weigh in on that, and then and sort of what does the current stakeholder process, what need is it not meeting today?
Yeah, so I would actually echo the thought that was just expressed. So I'm neither opposed to a stakeholder advisory committee nor advocating for it at this point, but I will say, you know, there for those who don't live in the CAISO initiative process every day, you know, there is a very open, public, transparent process by which all stakeholder views are given weight, and, you know, folks show up, at least when we have in-person meetings, and voice those views and submit formal public comments that are part of a record that CAISO staff then relies upon in recommending decisions to the board. And that process will continue, and we think it works very well. So I guess I would pose a question, and I'm not sure who it's to. So if somebody would like to sort of be the straw man advocate for a stakeholder advisory committee, you know, what view is it? So I will say, you know, in general, consensus views can form in that existing CAISO stakeholder process. Often they don't, and it's because stakeholders have different interests, right? And it's not a question of each party, you know, putting its values on a scale and weighing which one, you know, has more votes. You know, there are principles and as well as, you know, feasibility and market considerations that CAISO staff will go through in evaluating competing proposals. But in general, you know, on any given issue, we could be aligned or not aligned with any other stakeholder. And there's no consistency. It varies issue by issue. You know, sometimes all the load representatives are on one side of the table and all of the generators are on the other. Sometimes all of the, you know, regulated parties are on one side and all of the unregulated parties on another. There's no predicting it. So I'm struggling to understand how a stakeholder advisory committee, which presumably would consist of many of the same parties, would come to some consensus view that would, you know, shine light on something that's not coming out through that existing public stakeholder process.
This is Leah. I'd be happy to jump in with a response to that, but I don't want to talk out of turn if
you had a, there was someone else lined up.
Leah, why don't you go ahead, and if others want to speak up, they can right after.
Great. Yeah. So it's a good question, and I think a stakeholder advisory committee is certainly not going to ever guarantee consensus among stakeholders, and point well taken that it's very possible that stakeholders still won't reach consensus even if you have a formal advisory committee. But I do think the benefit is that if you have a group where you can discuss issues in advance, you have more likelihood of better understanding the different positions and nuances. And so I think it certainly is more likely that you will better understand those positions and potentially reach consensus. So no guarantee, but I think it's certainly more likely the more interaction in advance you have to better understand positions that you could reach that consensus and synthesize multiple interests and consider alternative options. And then I would just also note that stakeholder advisory committees are a part of all of the other ISOs and RTOs. And that's not to say that that has to be a fit for CAISO, but it's just to point out that clearly these groups have provided benefits and other ISOs and RTOs have seen the value for having those groups. So I think we shouldn't come from a starting place of, you know, there's no value to these groups or how do we best understand what the value is. But I think there is value there, but figuring out the best way to design the advisory committees for this market, I think, should be our task. So I think a good way to think about this is not so much what is missing in the current process. I think the current process has a lot of features that are really working well, but I mean, what can be enhanced? And I think there's a lot of opportunity for enhancing the current process through stakeholder advisory committees.
Hey, Rob, this is Tony. So Leah did a much better job. I'm glad she jumped in ahead of me. I think a lot of us have been, and I thought I might just chime in on this because you know, the public power entities have had a long history advocating for this type of structure, not to replace the stakeholder process as is, but to augment it. And part of the thinking in that regard is some of the things that Leah just referenced. One, you know, you can say that stakeholders will form consensus, but in fact, you know, it's really hard to do that without a formal mechanism. And any of us that have been in a FERC or a state commission settlement proceeding know that they often settle. And it's just a coincidence that having that sort of structure around the dialogue helps understand competing viewpoints and reach consensus. And also the dynamic of having the boards and go to the stakeholders and say, how come you couldn't reach consensus is also a factor that will help drive that greater effort than I think currently exists in the process. And it also provides a vehicle to provide more direct feedback to the boards from the stakeholder community rather than a serial run-up of individual stakeholders that have, you know, a minute to a minute and a half to digest their complex issue before the board as it is currently structured. So that was some of the thinking surrounding a lot of the support that has historically gone into formation of a stakeholder advisory committee of some sort.
Any other comments? Remember to press 10 if you'd like to ask a question.
Rob, it's Dave Rubin. The only thing I would add to the points that Leah and Tony just raised is, you know, what does it do in addition to the stakeholder process? The stakeholder process is great for the initiatives that the ISO has identified and is pursuing, but I do think a stakeholder advisory committee can enhance the process of prioritizing initiatives and raising other ones that might not otherwise have the chance to have their own individual stakeholder process. So it's a bit of, you know, reviewing what stakeholders are seeing with respect to their own businesses, being able to highlight that discussion and maybe find consensus and recommendations for prioritizing the ISO's sort of limited resources and what can be pursued. And putting a bit more transparency into that process.
Great. Thanks, David.
There's one more question in the remaining time that we have that I'd like to get to for a little bit if we can, and that's regarding support for the body of state regulators or other advisory committees. What consideration should be made for as the GRC sort of thinking about CAISO support for these other groups in terms of either the BOSER or other advisory committees? And Latho, do you want to take the lead on that one as well?
Thank you. I would. Let me provide just a little history on why this is in the conversation. My sense from the scoping paper was there was perhaps some confusion around this. The BOSER's been engaging, as we've talked about, and we have tried the Chair's Commission leading that facilitation, and that, of course, as the Chair moves and as smaller commissions struggle, and similarly for neutrality reasons, that's proved challenging. When we look to our peers, like OMS and so on, and weighed our options on how to most efficiently, cost-effectively sort of accomplish the work that the BOSER needs to in order to effectively support the market, out of that, we flowed a memorandum of understanding with the Western Interstate Energy Board to house independent staff for the BOSER, and that really came out of both the efficiency of not setting up an independent 501c3 and so on, but also the perception of among state governments of WEEB's neutrality and the ability to facilitate conversation between the states on these very complicated issues. But that MOU, which is publicly available, left the funding question very explicitly open, because that question needs to come back to the stakeholder process in the CAISO. And that, through our conversations with the CAISO and with different entities, and given that the BOSER's role in this space becomes a part of the informal governance, an informal part of the governance structure, perhaps a formal part, this seemed to us to be the appropriate forum to flesh the questions out and have the deliberation about the appropriate approach. So that's how we got here. When thinking about this, financial support for the BOSER as part of the overall governance reforms, balancing access across the footprint, I think there are two central considerations. What's the efficient approach to market governance that engenders trust and positive engagement on the material issues of the regional market so that it can continue to evolve and adapt to the changing energy landscape, the changing structure of the energy mix and energy prices and so on. There are two ways, I think, in which not supporting a lack of financial support for the BOSER results in poor outcomes. The first one that I worry about is that one or more Western states oppose an important change to the design of the regional market simply because they lack information and understanding. They're sort of operating in the dark, and so they take an oppositional stance. And I think the financial support for the BOSER helps overcome that status quo bias and inherent trust deficit that's created by the sort of governance structure that is rooted in the California board and the legal issues that we heard about earlier this morning. Second, I think there's a risk that one or more Western states oppose an important change because they're working from erroneous or incomplete understanding of the implications. And so they're operating from misinformation and have sort of gotten the wrong end of the stick and, again, take an oppositional stance and create churn and uncertainty for reasons that are just rooted in misunderstanding. So the EIM market operator, the CAISO, the participants, the stakeholders, I think all benefit from having a well-informed and thoughtful BOSER
there's less uncertainty and churn for everyone when the regulators can effectively engage the market at the appropriate times on material issues as opposed to misunderstandings. And I think it's a false economy to ignore the benefits of that effective BOSR. I think there's real costs involved with the bad outcomes. And, you know, we saw in the transitional committee, the CAISO charged with supporting the BOSRs, so the administrative fees are already paying for some regulator education and travel, although, as we've described, this doesn't meet the full needs. It is starting us down the road to equip regulators. I think an ineffective BOSR that can't convene regulators around these questions of consensus, as we've heard, consensus is challenging to find if you can't facilitate a conversation. And we at least all start from sort of very similar roles, even if our states have different interests in terms of our where we're situated in the market. I think an ineffective BOSR that can't convene regulators will then end up requiring that the CAISO and market participants spend the administrative dollars in essentially shuttle diplomacy, trying to keep states informed, engaged, and comfortable with the market evolution. And I think that's less efficient and more expensive and less constructive than an effective BOSR. I think it also has impacts on folks who are not directly regulated by the BOSR regulators, in that all stakeholders then face a more tumultuous stakeholder process, and that has its own transaction costs. And you know, markets don't like drama. Regulators don't like drama, and trying to keep the information flow open and effective reduces the drama quotient, and that's all to the good of transaction costs overall. I think there's reasons why other markets around the country have arrived at this model. When I look at their history, they've struggled with these same questions about who should be on the States Committee, how it should be most efficiently staffed, what its role is. You know, they've arrived at nuanced answers around the authority of those states committees. There are states committees that have much more authority than the BOSR is hoping is working towards. But they've all arrived at an understanding that it's more efficient and costs the market less to have an equipped regional states committee that's neutrally staffed and is able to really help states engage productively in the market governance. And as decision makers and accountability organizations, we really prize transparency in all of that. And so as a consideration, we have sought to be transparent about our approach and are very open to more conversation about how we can continue to expand that transparency in this space. So I look forward to engaging with stakeholders on these issues as we try to find a way to build the most efficient stakeholder engagement while accounting for the challenge of a single state ISO expanding slowly into a regional market. Thank you very much for the time.
Well, thank you. We appreciate that explanation. I think we've got time for a quick response.
Yeah, this is Therese. I'm going to step in and just ask for a quick response, and then we're going to transition.
Yeah, that'd be great.
This is Jennifer. I don't want to take time away from one of the GRC members, but if nobody has a question for Commissioner Tani, I'd like to offer some additional remarks.
Yes, let's take a few. Sorry, Rob, I'm going to step in here. Let's just take a few quick remarks on that topic, and then we will transition.
And I'd say if there are remarks that are consistent with Commissioner Tani, I'd rather hear from folks who may have a differing view.
Okay, that's fine.
Just in light of the time.
Yeah, this is Josh Walter with the EIM entities. Just real quick, you know, the EIM entities did not take this up in our short proposal, and you know, it frankly has to do with it being an issue where we could not and haven't really found consensus, and there are differing views. That being said, there are just some things to consider, right? So EDAM is not an RTO. It doesn't have issues involved with cost allocation for transmission under Order 1000, nor a common RA regime, which are kind of the focus of other regional states committees. And secondly, the West and EDAM, the footprint itself is unique in that public power is such a significant portion of the load served. And public power also, through BPA and WAPA, also own key transmission lines that enable market transfer. So just to kind of point those facts out, you know, for one, maybe for that second issue, I think the issue and role for public power is something that needs to be addressed in some fashion.
So this is Jennifer. Could I quickly counter something that was just said, Rob?
Very briefly.
Thank you. This idea that a regional state committee or a body of state regulators needs to be, for it to be funded and appropriately staffed, needs to somehow be tied to a formal RTO construct where we're dealing with decisions related to resource adequacy and transmission cost allocation. I don't think that's necessarily the right framework within which we should be having this conversation. Earlier during my remarks, I provided examples of other RTOs and ISOs that do fund their equivalent of the BOSR. One of those examples is the Organization of PJM States, or OPSI, which is funded by PJM, but actually doesn't have any type of Section 205 filing rights related to resource adequacy or transmission cost allocation. And in fact, the role that they play could arguably be said to be very comparable to the role of the BOSR. And so I want to make sure that we're clear that there's a lot of different ways that this could be structured. And at the end of the day, having state regulators educated and really engaged in the process is really, I think, the overarching consideration. And if there is a way to provide funding to make that more possible, I think it's ultimately a good move in the right direction. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody, for their comments on this section. And, Teresa, back to you.
Terrific. Thanks, Rob. So this process that we've gone through this morning just kind of underscores the work that the DRC has ahead of us and kind of where I started, which was you all gave us a very rich set of comments for us to kind of work through and to understand in our deliberative process. I know there were other topics that were here for us to discuss today, but looking at the time, we have just 10 minutes left. What I'd like to do at this point is just really open it up to the GRC or to anybody that's listening for a question or comment on something that we didn't get to, something that's important to you that you'd like to just be sure is flagged for the Governance Review Committee as we kind of step into process, kind of deliberation on process of how to take in all of these comments and decide our next steps. So I'm just going to the GRC, if there's anything that you were kind of hoping to get a question asked on one of the other topics, I'd like to give you a chance for that now. And also to the public, press 10 if you have a question or a comment.
Therese, this is Eric Eisenman. I would be interested in any comments from stakeholders on the policy roadmap. We've had a lot of discussions, and this is with my PG&E hat on, a lot of discussions over the years on the policy roadmap and how to prioritize. And so I'd be interested if stakeholders, especially from outside of California, EIM entities, including our panelists, had any views on that they could quickly share in these remaining minutes. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, Eric. So it is a question about a role for the governing body related to the policy roadmap. Any of the panelists want to take a response to that?
Josh,
sure, this is Leah. I can Dave, you go ahead. I'll see if you don't cover what I was going to say, then I'll jump in. But you go ahead.
Eric, it is an issue that we addressed in our white paper. So just very briefly, it is something that we thought is actually a gap in the governance process today, where neither the EIM governing body nor the ISO Board of Governors has sort of formal approval over the roadmap. And we really thought that they should, sort of consistent the way they have it over the transmission plan, that it is such an important document in setting out the priorities that the ISO is going to be working on in this year and in future years, that it should have a bit more formal approval process to it. Again, this is never to say that a market issue or some exigent circumstance shouldn't come up, that couldn't come up, that the roadmap had to be fixed or changed. It could always go back, but at least then you have a bit more transparency on the process of that change, the reasons for it, and more oversight to it. So for us, it's something that is that can be an improvement today, and then it would just feed into whoever has that authority, whether it's primary or joint over the market, would then have that ability to approve the roadmap as well.
Great. Thanks, David.
Yeah, thank Leah, you. That was helpful.
Great. Thanks, Eric.
No, I agree with everything David said. Yeah, very consistent with our position on that.
Okay. Governance Review Committee, any other questions that you want to get a response from? Is there anybody in the queue?
Yes, we have a couple. First one is from Tuli Hakia. Please go ahead.
Hi, yes, good morning. Tuli Hakala from Chelan PUD. I have a comment followed by kind of a question slash request. We had a lot of discussion earlier when we were talking about issue one, kind of recognizing that we're working within an existing statutory framework and under existing California corporate law, and that framework kind of puts some sideboards around the types of ideas and proposals that we're looking at. We've taken our own look at the CAISO organic statutes, and we've identified some areas that frankly seem a little bit problematic, where CAISO has directives to look out for the interests of California ratepayers. And we have seen some other parts of the statutes that appear dormant at the moment, but we think could be potentially relevant to this conversation about having a more regional market. For example, there's a section on a regional compact possibility. There's language about an electricity oversight board. We understand it's defunct now. But what we think could be helpful is having CAISO Council provide some feedback to the stakeholder process on their understanding of what is that legal framework that the CAISO has to operate under, touching on both that general corporate law and the CAISO's organic statutes, and kind of helping us understand what is that maximum level of independence that we could achieve under existing law, which seems to be a goal for many, although, you know, obviously not all stakeholders. So our request would be getting that kind of feedback from CAISO Council in some way. Thank you.
Thanks, Tuli. I think that maybe there are some questions there. I don't know, Peter, if you want to, or Roger, if you want to suggest maybe the best way to approach that.
Yeah, I think the best way to approach that would be maybe to set something up separate from today. It's a longer discussion, and I think we've done it in, you know, various different forums, and I'm sure Dan could probably rattle off 90% of it off the top of his head, but it would take some time, and it would probably raise additional questions.
Great. Thanks, Roger. Are there others in the queue?
Yes, we have one from Vijay Satoy. Please go ahead.
Hello, yeah. Hi, this is Vijay Satoy of WRA. I just wanted to offer a comment to the earlier conversation regarding the BASR funding. I wanted to offer a bit of an interesting reality observation from I call the baby days of the EIM when it was born, and I was involved representing Oregon, is I urge the EIM entities and the EDAM potential participants to think of a whole new paradigm we have of complex set of players, a whole new overlaying set of BAA footprints, and it boils down to efficiency and ease of communicating complex issues that, as Commissioner Thani brought up in her own way, is varying levels of knowledge and expertise. So I urge this entire group to please also think of the opportunity cost that's at stake in not engaging the BOSSER in an effective way, that you would have the very membership and the staff of the utilities going out and connecting in forums and ways that often has different rules of procedure of communication. Thank you.
Thank you, Vijay. Hey, anyone else in the queue?
The next will be from Lauren Tenney Denson. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning. This is Lauren Tenney Denison with the Public Power Council. I just wanted to emphasize, Leah had talked about this in her presentation, but I wanted to emphasize the importance of the independent market expert. We see this as a really helpful tool to inform both stakeholders and the EIM governing body. There was a lot of discussion throughout today about the importance of having educated stakeholders, and we think this is a really good tool that could help us get there and improve the development of particularly of the development of EDAM as we move forward. So I just wanted to emphasize our interest in that.
Thanks, Lauren. Okay, with the last 2 minutes, here's what I'd like to just kind of end where I began, which is the next step for the Governance Review Committee. We are going to, yes.
This is Jennifer. I'm so sorry to interrupt. We have one more question on the phone.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay, Amy. McNally, please go ahead.
Yes. Hi, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Go right ahead.
I just wanted to add to the question from the person from Oregon with not necessarily an additional question segment, but I think it's really important that when that question is answered regarding the legality or legal aspects of the governance structure reflecting back to the state of California, that it's understood that whatever that answer is remains subject to change within the state of California system. And I think from a governance standpoint, I would be thrilled to see this group produce, whether I can participate in any degree or not, I would still be thrilled. I think a lot of people would be very interested and benefit from an analysis of that perpetuating forward, because again, that is the crux of, irrespective of whatever group is structured on an administrative basis, that's the crux of ultimate authority looking ahead. So I just wanted to add that. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy. Are there any other comments on the line? I don't want to cut any others.
No, there is no further questions.
Terrific. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to end where we started, which is the Governance Review Committee really has a fair amount of work to do to figure out what our next steps are. I think just this conversation underscores kind of the depth and breadth of the comments that we need to consider. So we will kind of, our next task is to determine what our next steps are in terms of work product and really how to digest these comments. As I said, there is this tentative schedule out there that suggested a straw proposal by April 28th. I think we're going to look at that and revisit that. And what you can expect from us is kind of an update of what we think our next steps are. As we've said from the beginning, we commit to many opportunities to have conversation on these issues. So this was really a desire to spend 4 hours talking about this with you. We'll continue to have opportunities for you to provide input and to hear these conversations. And so just we will communicate. You'll hear updates from us about what comes next. Thank you. So, and actually, I want to give a tremendous thank you to the panelists today. Thank you for all the 16 parties that submitted comments into this process, for the five of you that were willing to give presentations and answer questions, and thank you to everyone. And with that, we will adjourn.
Thank you.
Thank you, and that does conclude your conference for today. Thank you for using AT&T teleconferencing. You may now disconnect.